Damage report! Guidance system out. Auxiliary steering out.
Divert! Divert!
She won't answer the helm. We're locked into the moon's gravitational pull. What do we do? We die.
It's movie time.
What's up? Welcome back, everybody. It's the Movie Time Podcast from your Pop Czar pals over at Pop Czar Press. That's a lot of P's, but we got a lot of E's. A lot of popcorn. Popcorn? I don't think so. It's a Movie Time Podcast where we talk about movies that we love or we dislike strongly. Not a lot of dislike. This is Nathan Evans, managing editor of PopZara.com, back once again. And on the other side of the fence is my special co-host, Mr. Ethan Brem. Ethan, welcome back.
Hey, how's it going?
Welcome back. So, did you get the little clip at the beginning? You got what that's from?
Yeah, I was trying to figure it out. I was like, did I do the wrong movie?
You know, that could happen. Like, did you mean the last Tango in Paris?
So, yeah, that's what I watched was The Last Tango in Paris.
We would have a very different conversation if we were talking about The Last Tango in Paris. Would you like some butter? But this was an interesting pick. You and I had chatted about these movies before, but we never had a good time to bring them up. I don't think they were on the top five of either of us, which is why probably we weren't like champing at the bit. Yeah, mm-hmm. I said it right. Champing to talk about them. But we are talking about two movies from 1984, The Last Starfighter, and we are talking about Cloak and Dagger. And you know what's funny? I did not know this before because I think I left it up to you if we were going to do one or two.
Yeah.
Did you know these movies came out the same day?
Yeah, they were released as a double feature, right?
And there's not any direct, there's nothing directly linking them, but there's a lot of like ancillary links to them.
Yeah,
like
one of them is not even sci-fi. Like one of them is not even a sci-fi movie, but it almost feels like it is tangentially sci-fi a little bit.
What's so funny is, and we can get into the odds and ends and ins and outs, but these movies are, and I said this, I broke this down, these movies are like perfect encapsulations of the early 1980s.
Yeah.
They are like, if you went back in time and just put the years in a bottle, you would get The Last Starfighter and you would get Cloak and Dagger as far as cinema goes.
Well, can I take the soapbox for a second?
Sure.
I'd like to claim that 1984 is the greatest year ever in pop cinema. I'm going to read off just some movies that came out all in 1984.
Besides Cloak and Dagger
and The Last Starfighter, we also have Neverending Story, Nightmare on Elm Street, Beverly Hills Cop, Revenge of the Nerds, Gremlins, Ghostbusters, Karate Kid, The Terminator, Police Academy, Muppets Take Manhattan, Temple of Doom, 16 Candles, Star Trek III, Romancing the Stone. And you also have movies that aren't great, like Red Dawn, Footloose, Dune,
Man. Not great. We're get out of here. Soapbox revoked.
Well, and then you have like these movies, and then you have like Friday the 13th Part 4, which I think is one of the better Friday the 13th. Blood Simple. I mean, come on, movies are
I love Blood Simple. Yeah.
Flamingo Kid, Bachelor Party, Splash, Amadeus won Best Picture.
Let's just stop right there, real quick.
Yeah.
You just mentioned Splash, Amadeus, and we're talking about Last Starfighter. If you didn't tell anybody, if an alien came down, who is this guy? Because everybody looks Tom Hulce and Tom Hanks.
Yeah.
And
Steve
who's in this movie? Lance Guest. They all look like 1984 Tom Hanks. They look exactly the same.
Yeah. I mean, one year all these movies came out. That's phenomenal.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's incredible. It's not a great year for, you look at the other movies that were nominated for Best Picture besides Amadeus. Most people probably haven't even heard of them. But then you got just pop culture was just movies were crossing over in a way that had not been seen. I mean, we're past the 70s, the artsy new wave 70s, and we're into the 80s here.
You know, chronologically, you're even more right than you think of. This is the post-Star Wars age. This is the year after Star Wars concluded. So we thought.
Yep.
Right.
Yeah.
The FCC in the United States had changed their laws, I think in 1982 or 83, I forget, to allow more commercialization between toys, television, and movies.
Yeah. Like the G.I. Joes.
Mm-hmm. We talked about that, where they had to get around it by doing comic books, like Transformers.
You could only have so much animation or something in a commercial, unless it was like based off of a cartoon or something.
There's a lot of ways around it, but if you start watching Saturday morning cartoons, this is really the era when Saturday morning really exploded. Like, the 70s were good, but the 80s were gold. Like, there's a reason why we're going through the 1980s renaissance, for better or for worse. I will say this, though. Did you finish your list, by the way? I didn't mean to interrupt you.
Yeah, no. Well, I also wanted to note at least nine of these movies launched successful franchises. They weren't just a part of, like, not including Star Trek 3, Friday the 13th, Part 4. Like, they were the beginning of franchises, which is incredible as well. Also, Stop Making Sense. That was the other one I wanted to mention.
Oh, Stop Making Sense. You know, it's funny. We never talked about, we have never done, I don't think, Friday the 13th or Nightmare on Elm Street on this podcast yet.
That'd be a fun one, yeah.
You know, it's funny. I was doing a deep dive just to go off the beaten path real quick. The same people involved in both. In fact, you mentioned Blood Simple.
Yeah.
The Coen brothers, right?
Yeah.
The Coens were actually involved in some of that too with Evil Dead. Like, it would be so interesting for someone to do a deep dive of Friday the 13th, Nightmare on Elm Street, Evil Dead, and the Coen brothers. And they all match up. They all link up. There's a thorough line right there.
Someone in one of these movies we're going to talk about was in Raising Arizona too. And I can't remember.
Oh, the fat nerd.
Maury or Murray or whatever.
Let me put it this way. Only in the 1980s, only in 1984, could you have a children's film where one of the major adult characters gets murdered, shoved into a trunk, and the little child, has to hide next to the corpse because the bad guys are trying to murder him. This is a children's film, by the way. Cloak and Dagger.
Meanwhile, Stand By Me, the entire movie is about them just journeying to see
a dead body. The 80s, the decade that thrilled you and traumatized you all at once. Like, you like drowning horses? I got a movie for you.
I had never seen either of these movies, can I just
really?
Say?
Really? Okay.
I had always wanted to. I actually always used to get The Last Starfighter mixed up with The Flight of the Navigator for some reason.
Oh, no, I did too, because the kid looks exactly like Henry Thomas.
Yeah, I don't know why. Oh, no. I used to get the titles because I'd never seen them. I'd never seen Flight of the Navigator either, which I think also came out. No, that was 86.
They're trying to remake it. Like, let's just be fair here. Flight of the Navigator, they're trying to remake. Good luck with that. They're trying to either sequelize or soft reboot, whatever they call it, The Last Starfighter. That looks like it might actually happen, but cross your fingers it doesn't. This is the 80s. Basically, the 80s existed so talentless, hacky producers can strip mine intellectual property they had nothing to do with, so they can create crappy streaming programs. Can we say that? Is that allowed?
Yeah.
And if you watch what happened with Disney Plus, the subscription service, started off strong. Everybody thought it's going to kill Netflix. No, that didn't happen. In fact, this, like, I think it's both mostly Disney Plus and a lot of HBO Max or Max, whatever they're calling it. They bet their horses on 80s nostalgia a lot, and it didn't pan out, didn't work. And so because you make inferior versions. Oh, one more thing about 1980s kids movies that you don't see anymore, aside from the casual racism and casual F-bombs, like, and I don't mean F-U-C-K, I mean the other one. Mm-hmm. Little children would swear all the time. Little kids, little girls, little boys, just hurling out S-words, F-bombs, everything.
Remember, Monster Squad has a million swear words in it.
Yeah, we're going to say Monster Squad for another time, but Monster Squad has the greatest kid swearing ever in a children's film, ever. It has Dracula grabbing the little girl and calling her a name. And you will not see that in the Disney remake, I promise.
No, I promise, yeah. I will say, though, Henry Thomas's character is kind of against type for 80s kids in Cloak and Dagger. I think he kind of plays the innocent thing really, really well, which is also even opposite of Elliot from E.T.
Well, he was, according to Roger Ebert, the greatest child performer, I think, I think he called him, like, the greatest performance he's ever seen by a child or something.
E.T., yeah. I mean, he's great in E.T. He's great in this, too, I will say.
You know, I guess I should get the stereotypes out of the way. In Cloak and Dagger, we are jumping way ahead. We will go through all this. What's his name in Cloak and Dagger?
Dabney Coleman.
Oh, no, I love Dabney Coleman. Davey. Davey, sorry.
Yeah.
The little girl who plays Davey's friend, Kim.
Yeah.
She's adorable. She's fantastic.
Yeah.
But I think they directed her. It's like, okay, little girl, we want you to act like a stereotypical Jewish mother. Because if you look at her, the way she talks, her mannerisms, she talks like a nagging Jewish grandmother to Davey the whole time. And I thought to myself, I've seen this girl before. And I looked it up and I thought, I think she was one of the little girls in Twilight Zone, the movie.
Yeah.
Like, you know the Steven Spielberg scene, the kick the can scene?
It was. Yeah.
It wasn't her.
Really?
Yeah. She was
Are
in
you Twi- sure?
No, no, get this. She
I
was in
that
Twilight
was
Zone.
Time.
No. That's the thing. That's your mind playing a trick on you.
Okay.
You think Elliot, you think Davey, you think Henry Thomas, you think E.T., right? So Steven Spielberg did the kick the can sequence with Scatman Crothers in Twilight Zone. Great scene. She actually played the little girl on the airplane in the Gremlin scene with John Lithgow.
At the end.
Yeah. But the little girls that are in Twilight Zone, by the way, another 1980s thing, not all those children survived that movie. Look it up.
Yeah. Killed John Landis' career.
Well, did something to it. But I'll say this. No, I thought she was one of the little girls, the little Jewish girls that, you know, I thought that was the same performance. No, it's not. She's just an old soul. So.
Yeah, she was cute. Yeah.
Yeah, she was good.
Yeah, kid actors were just better back then. I mean, we've said this before, but they were just so much better.
Less precocious. Like.
Yeah, they weren't cast for their looks. They were cast for their just raw ability to convey things.
I also think they were cast if they fit a stereotype. Like, are you fat?
Yeah, exactly.
Are you black? Are you butch? Are you dweeby? Are you nerdy? Yeah. Are you good looking? You know, like River Phoenix could be all those things. You know,
Wolfgang and the Explorers.
Yeah, but he didn't make it out of the 90s. No. Drugs are bad, kids. Don't do them. And if you do them where people can save your life. So don't do it in front of clubs. But, okay, well, we've gone backwards. But
what do you want to delve into first here?
Well, they both came the same. I think the most popular one, I think let's just get this one out of the way. Let's talk about The Last Starfighter because this is clearly the most popular out of these two. In fact, this is one of those films that we've heard this story before, did not do very well in theaters, but thanks to VHS and cable television became a phenomenon. And you said you've never seen it before, but you've heard of it.
Oh, yeah.
And the words The Last Starfighter have become shorthand in film terminology for the type of movie it is. It's like saying Groundhog's Day is like a temporal repeat movie, right? Mm-hmm. Well, when you have Last Starfighter, it's a much smaller list, Ethan. But it is a type of movie where a kid or something plays a video game and the video game trains him to do the real thing. In fact, we got another one coming this summer, next month, in theaters. Did you know?
Gran Turismo?
Gran Turismo, yep.
Yeah.
Same thing. You know, it's funny. Some of the people trying to remake this movie were Seth Rogen and Evan, what's his partner? Evan something?
Evan Goldberg.
Yeah, they do all the movies together. They had the rights to do The Last Starfighter. I don't know what happened. I think they lost them, but they didn't give up. They made a TV show out of it. It was called Future Man with the kid from...
Oh, with Josh Hutcherson?
Yeah. In fact, they referenced
that was
The
based
Last Starfighter.
Of this?
No, it was based on the idea of this.
The idea of this, though, it was inspired by about it. Oh, cool. I'd never seen that show, but I know it.
It was okay. There's a funny joke at the beginning where he says, "Oh, it's just like The Last Starfighter." It's like, no, yeah. Huh. But no, Seth Green and both of them, they were going to do the remake of The Last Starfighter. It didn't happen though.
Interesting. Well. This also has a lot of spiritual connections to Tron, obviously. Not just the video game going. I mean, Tron, he physically goes into the video game.
Mm-hmm.
But also, there are two of the very early examples of CGI. One better than the other, I will say. and we'll probably talk about that.
Yeah, we could talk about that because that's going to be a stumbling block for a lot of people trying to enjoy this movie now.
It is. And I like the movie. It was a stumbling block for me too, and I'm not even the kind of person who would normally care about that. But it was taking me out of the movie a couple of times.
It does, and
it doesn't help that the outer space stuff is also. I was struggling to kind of buy into the importance of it. I think, and I don't know if that was making the effects feel worse or if the effects were making me buy into the importance of it.
Well, that's something we have to talk to talk about, because you can't watch this movie in 2023 and not discuss that. Yeah. But I will say this, going back to it, Last Starfighter. It's, don't quote me on this, but I was reading somewhere, I think the people who worked on the effects on this, the CG effects, actually did work on Tron. Like, there was an effort at the time for CG companies, or as we know it now, computer graphics, to emerge. I know the company that became Pixar, they were doing, at the time, George Lucas owned them. And the only major mainstream project they ever manifested was the Genesis bombing scene in Star Trek, The Wrath of Khan,
yeah.
Yeah, but again, that was very small. That was very small. It was not a major momentous, like, you know, plot-driven point like the last Star Trek was.
Well, Nicholas Meyer claims that was the very first CGI ever in a movie.
Everybody claims they're the first.
I know. But so, I don't know what would be, I don't know what would have been before that, I guess, but...
I mean, there's probably something somewhere that somebody did at some point, but at the end of the day, though, it all came out of this Cambrian explosion. This all emerged in this time period, I think we can say. Yeah. And so, but you're right. The Tron special effects were actually very different. The Tron effects were actually rendered on a computer and animated like a traditional film. And there was also rotoscoping and everything. But yeah, it's crazy at the time. Like, no one knew what animation was going to become. Disney was faltering, you know, nearing collapse.
Even because of that, they were just the company was just, before Eisner had it, was in turmoil.
It was turmoil.
Deep turmoil. Like, they were, the movies were awful. They weren't even, they were losing money everywhere.
But you also had several absconding animators like Don Bluth and Tim Burton. They were re-energizing animation in their own way. Sort of like, it's kind of like what happened to Robert Zemeckis years ago, like in the 2000s after, what was that movie he did with Harrison Ford? What Lies Beneath, I think, where he just dedicated his entire career to doing crappy lifelike animation.
Yeah. Like the Beowulf and Polar Express.
Yeah. It didn't, never really worked out.
Yeah.
But you know, you had animators like Ralph Bakshi who were big on rotoscoping, you know,
Cool World.
Well, you know, it's funny. There is a movie that's very similar to Last Starfighter that was one of those movies. Let me look it up, what it's called. It's called Star Chaser, The Legend of Orin. Came out in 80. It was supposed to come out in 84, the same year this came out.
Huh.
Yeah. Okay. Have you ever seen it?
I know the name. I've never seen it, though.
It is... I never knew that animation could be boring, right? Huh. Yeah. I never knew that animation could be boring. Whoop, sorry. I got a trailer playing. You can't see it at home, if you're watching, if you're listening, go look up the trailer for Star Chaser, The Legend of Orin. And I don't know if you could see my screen, Ethan, but if you look at the animation, it's completely CG rendered rotoscoped animation that looks beautiful, right? It looks beautiful in the context of the film, really smooth.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, it's boring as toast, and the movie itself plays like a Hanna-Barbera episode, so naturally it didn't do anything.
But it looks like G.I. Joe.
But you look at this compared to Last Starfighter, and this looks better. Yeah. Like, this looks much better.
Well, Last Starfighter, also, I was thinking about it, and Tron, it's very crude animation, too, but there's an identity to it that fits with the film, and it fits with the premise of they're inside a video game, and you just accept this reality, and it's kind of cool. Like, the colors of Tron are a big part of it, too. Whereas, like, in The Last Starfighter, it feels like an animation student has just made these really, really wonky, flavorless things. And that's what wasn't working for me. It wasn't the crudity of it. It was just the lack of artistry. Like, matte paintings look fake in old movies, but still, there's always some sort of artistic representation on the canvas.
Because I think the CG is... The movie is served by the CG. The CG does not serve the movie. And I think when you have, you know, you have this explosion of people coming out of this period, including James Cameron. You have John Carpenter, who, by the way, is tangentially related to this movie because of the director. You have, who's the director? Yeah. Goodness gracious.
Nick Castle,
a.k.a. Michael Myers himself.
The very first Michael Myers, yeah. And, and he's done a couple things throughout the years that were pretty...
Oh, yeah. He's an interesting guy.
I've seen him in interviews. I like Nick Castle a lot, just as a guy.
Yeah, he did the story for Hook, speaking of, you know, Spielberg. Yeah. But no, he did a movie that I used to love as a kid that I do not dare watch now because I love the movie. I know it's probably not as good as I thought. He did the movie A Boy Who Could Fly. That's okay. Another film that would never come out today. It was just it's a 1980s time capsule about autistic boy, a suicidal girl in an insane asylum, and the boy thinks he can fly. And spoiler, he can. It's I don't even know how to explain it. It's one of his better films. It might actually be better than Last Starfighter for talking just cinematics. But I think the reason we talk about Last Starfighter isn't because of its, you know, let's be honest, it's primitive CG by today's standards, or it's lackluster story by today's standards. There's something about it that has made this film beloved. And I think it's beloved in spite of its flaws, because this movie is flawed in, not fatal ways, but it's flawed. You have to come to it accepting those flaws. And if you don't, you're not going to want to watch it. That's just the way it is.
It's not perfect. It's not even close, but you watch the last Starfighter and you can see why 80s kids were obsessed with sci-fi. And you can see why it's a Star Wars influenced movie, but it takes some stuff from like Star Trek and from even Tron, and it just kind of, and even some like a little bit of 50s sci-fi, and it's almost like a love letter to sci-fi in general, and it uses these different parts, and it has some really cool production design, and despite the special effects being terrible, like the makeup is good and the creatures designs are cool.
You know what's funny about the special
costumes?
Effects? You know, I don't want to use the word terrible, right? Because they are aged.
Yeah, you know what I mean. But
no, but but you can see why they were attracted to them. Like, I love miniatures. I do. I love miniatures. And at the time, we were still doing miniatures. We were still doing stop motion. You know, you go back even to the 90s, they were still doing that optical effects because CG just wasn't there. Even James Cameron couldn't crack it yet.
Yeah.
But the truth of the matter is, there's a saying: bad practical effects age like wine, bad CG ages like rot. CG does not age well. It just does not age well. Even good CG does not age well. But practical effects, I think they actually look better now than they did back in the day because you can see the craft in them.
Yeah.
And there are moments in The Last Starfighter that use practical effects and they have not aged badly. They look really nice. Yeah. They're fun to watch.
Because you're not trying to watching bad practical effects now. When they first came out, you're trying to almost like create an illusion that something is really happening. But now you know that it's very much going to be, you expect it to be dated, I guess. Well, whereas in CG animation, we use CG animation so much now, and it successfully creates an illusion of realism, whereas back then it just didn't cut it. Whereas practical effects, I think there's a ceiling that everyone kind of accepts.
It's true, but I also think it's also indicative on the time we live in, where you hear complaints about bad CG, you hear complaints about rush CG even in $300 million blockbusters.
Yeah, Black Panther.
Yeah, or more recently, The Flash. The Flash came out, and all the talk besides the star Ezra Miller was about how shoddy the CG looked. And have you seen The Flash yet?
No, I haven't seen it.
I've seen it. It's not as bad as people make it out to be. Let's just be honest. Yeah. It's nothing could be as bad as they make it out to be. It's got moments of brilliance, but it is plagued with some of the worst CG I have ever seen in a film. It is plagued with it. And the CG, like The Last Starfighter, unlike The Last Starfighter, was used as a disservice. It was used to create things that should not exist, like CG Christopher Reeve, spoiler, you know, resurrecting dead actors that have been dead for 70 years to be in your movie. It just doesn't serve it. You know, this year alone, I remember I saw Ant-Man and Quantumania and coming out just bored by how it looked. CG has gotten to the point where it's factory production line. And look, I'm not crapping on CG artists. You do a good job, but there's too many of you. And the problem is, you watch an old movie. I think you and I talked about this. You watch an old special effects film without CG, and your mind is like a magician. You're like, how did they do that? How was that a hand puppet? Was that practical effects? Was that a squib? You don't know until you figure it out. Was that a miniature? But with CG, you know the answer every time. CG. That's it. There's no mystery there. Someone rendered it in a computer.
But you're right that there's too many of them, and I think that it's easy to fool people into thinking that you're a good CG artists, whereas practical effects, you really can't fool people.
Well, I don't think anything is a better example of that than Avatar, The Way of the Water. You know, you have James Cameron, you know, who was ridiculed for taking, what, 13 years to make a sequel, you know, going over budget. People thought he's a madman, da-da-da. And then you watch the film, and whether you like the film or not, it's gorgeous. And the CG is perfect. Like, it looked great. It looks fantastic. It breaks all the rules of CG. It's CG supposed to be in the dark to hide the rough edges. This movie was sparkling underwater, like in direct sunshine. It is fantastic. But that's James Cameron. That's the same guy who gave you Terminator and Aliens. Yeah. You know,
Titanic.
And I don't think the guy who played Michael Myers is quite James Cameron level, although I think they did traipse in the same circles a little bit. I mentioned John Carpenter. I know that Nick Castle was a big friend, big collaborator with John Carpenter. I think he was in that music video for Big Trouble Little China.
Okay.
You know, like when in the one with Carpenter singing in his bathrobe.
Yeah.
Like, I think Nick Castle's in there playing one of the instruments.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah, if you knew John Carpenter in the 70s or 80s, you were in one of his music videos. That just happens.
Adrian Barbeau.
Of course, everybody.
I will say the best part of The Last Starfighter is the trailer park scenes.
Yes, thank you. Thank you.
I will say Nick Castle, I think, does a superb job with the photography. And I don't know who his DP was. But there's like this one shot that he went to a couple times. There's one angle probably of like the trailer park at night with like the stars in the background. And it was just I was just obsessed with that shot. I was like, yeah, show it again. And just everything at the trailer park, his use of this location, I think makes the trailer park feel cool. Like you want to go there. And I think both of these movies, Cloak and Dagger and The Last Starfighter, do locations exceptionally well, but differently, whereas Cloak and Dagger, it's all over. It's exploratory. You're all over San Antonio. Whereas The Last Starfighter is only in this trailer park. But you still feel like you're there and you feel like you want to be there.
By the way, the cinematographer was a guy named King Baggett. He doesn't even have a Wikipedia page, but you know what?
Yeah.
Cinematographer for Revenge of the Nerds.
American Gigolo too.
Dr. Detroit. Yep, a lot of music video stuff. So no surprise there. A lot of Beatles stuff, Madonna stuff, and Cheech and Chong's next movie.
Music video guys are good DPs. I will say
there has never been a better factory system for commercial directors than music videos. Which explains why we don't have any good commercial directors anymore, because they don't make music videos anymore. So not really, but. I was talking to one of our producers about that. I love the trailer park scenes. The trailer park scenes, it feels like it's like a nice warm 1980s blanket because it feels soft. It feels welcoming. Yeah. You don't know what's going to happen in this trailer park. Are there going to be gremlins? Are there going to be trolls? Are there going to be aliens? Like anything could happen in a 1980s trailer park.
It doesn't feel like dirty. It feels like welcoming, and you it feels nostalgic. And
I love just it.
That scene where he's beating the record on the cabinet on the video game cabinet.
Put that
and
down.
the whole community, the whole neighborhood is there cheering him on. You're like, yes, like you want to be there. You want to go into that convenience store. It's so good.
We should set this up, by the way. Both Last Starfighter and Cloak and Dagger have a few check boxes that every proper 1980s movie needed. You had kids without parents or missing a parent, and the dad's not there in Last Starfighter. The mom's dead.
Mentioned, but they kind of retcon it a little bit. Yeah,
like the whole concept was latchkey kids. Like that was deal because you had single parent households, and it's normally the father wants to win the son or daughter's approval, but the mother is trying to struggle. We could be here all day naming movies that have this trope. There are thousands of them, but I also what is it called? You have to have real danger. The children need to be in real danger. Like in the case of Cloak and Dagger, that's at the end of a gun. but you also have a blending of sci-fi fantasy. Is it sci-fi? Is it fantasy? Is it neither? Is it a dream? We don't know. Sometimes it's never explained because we don't need everything explained to us.
You have a mentor?
Yeah, lots of mentors. And sometimes the mentors die but come back.
Sometimes they're imaginary.
Yeah, sometimes they're imaginary. But they still come back. That's the thing.
That's the Star Wars. That's the Obi-Wan Force Ghost.
Exactly.
That's exactly what that is. Yeah.
Like some people could see it as like a latent schizophrenia, whatever. But at the end of the day, like, you can't keep a good mentor down. His head gets chopped off. He gets blown away with bullets. He gets destroyed. Whatever. He's coming back to save your ass because it's the 1980s.
My biggest problem with The Last Starfighter, and I really like this movie, but
you can like flawed things.
Yeah, totally. And this is like perfect example of that. But my biggest problem wasn't even the CG. It was they tried to do the Luke Obi-Wan thing with Alex, the main guy, and Centauri, played by Robert Preston.
The great Robert Preston.
And they develop absolutely hardly a rapport between these two characters. And then, spoiler alert, Centauri gets killed, basically, or so you think. and they play it, like, try to make it this emotional moment. But first of all, the guy who plays Alex, what's his name?
Is it Lance Guest?
Lance Guest, yes.
Yeah.
He's not a good enough actor to pull this off. He tries to make it like this whole, oh no, like the Luke Obi-Wan thing. but then you're like, why do we care that this guy died? Like, there's no establishment other than he's like this weird character.
Yeah, they don't really have any chemistry.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That was my biggest thing, and they brought him back, and it felt like cringy.
That was a reshoot, according to the.
Oh yeah, it felt like a reshoot. Yeah. Oh my goodness.
Like, gotta have him back.
Yeah, it was so cringy. That was my least favorite part of the movie. Honestly, I wonder
if they thought if they were going to sell toys of Centauri, and I was like, no child is going to want that. You know what's funny? So I put a note. I thought of something similar, but I have a different angle on it. I agree with you, by the way. It feels like it's trapped. Here's my notes. I wrote down, it feels like it's trapped between two very different cinematic worlds.
Yeah.
Like the schmaltzy, mellow, like pre-Star Wars sci-fi and like post-Star Wars spectacle and bombast. Like, yeah. If you like, there's a very certain type of sci-fi that existed before Star Wars that does not exist anymore. It was eradicated in the 80s. What's the word I'm looking for? Flash Gordon, for example, Logan's Run. You know, you have.
Oh yeah.
Like, even to be honest with you, Planet of the Apes sci-fi was not funny. It was not effervescent. It wasn't cheerful. It was usually sad. It usually involved death and genocide. And when you have The Last Starfighter, it still has elements of that, right? Like, it looks like it's obviously crimping from Star Wars, which it totally is.
Mm.
But then you have the coloring of a 70s. Like, when they go to the planet, when they go to outer space and they meet the aliens. By the way, who the hell designed an alien race of male pattern baldness on everyone?
I know. Even the women had old man hair.
Well, you know, that there's that funny scene when Alex is opening the door to the fake DeLorean. And you start seeing the lady's legs, like, ooh, yeah. Like, ooh. And the right when they get to the head, you're like, no! No! It's like Larry David. Yeah. Everyone looks like Larry David. But you know what I mean? It's like, you look at that, and everything looks like a 70s sci-fi movie, but it wants to feel like a Star Wars movie.
Go ahead, sorry.
No, I was going to say, and the thing I love Robert Preston. I love The Music Man. I don't know if you've ever seen it. But that style of acting was obsolete in 1984. Like, I'm going to go over here. I'm going to go over there. Look at me. Yeah, we're going to do this, and we're going to do that, and yeah, bang, bang, bang. And it doesn't work.
Performative. I will say there were a lot of touches of Star Trek here with the villains, like the races. Of like the villain races and stuff, like a lot of it felt very Trekkian.
You mean standing on the bridge yelling at each other?
Yeah, just a lot of that stuff, which obviously has its foot planted in the 50s sci-fi. A lot of the space stuff in the 50s, like I was thinking, but what was it? When Worlds Collide? I don't know if you've ever seen that one. It kind of had. The spaceship even looked kind of like the headquarters. Well,
the spaceships were designed. A lot of the stuff was designed by the people who worked on like Blade Runner and Star Wars.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Totally. There were some things too that reminded me of Blade Runner. Even.
Spinner car. Exactly. You know, from the one that was in Blade Runner was, I think.
Yeah, like the gimbal thing.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, and then you have I was gonna say too that the entire sequence with Centauri with the car, and when he picks him up, I really liked the tone of that. It felt so like surrealistic, almost like Brazil.
Oh yeah. Oh,
it had a real like this wild, wacky, and then that's like the only part of the movie that had that.
You know what's funny?
It's so weird.
I like Robert Preston as an actor in his own things, but I think had they had a British actor play, like if they would have had a British like
Bill Daniels,
who's at the time, like one of the Pythons actually, because the Pythons were in all those crazy sci-fi movies. Like Jim Henson was working with what's his name? What was the one Python there? Eric Idle would have been fun too. But you know, someone. You could get away with that type of frivolity if they have an English accent. I'm sorry, but it's just the rules.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, you're not going to go for the staid Obi-Wan, like, monk. You need someone who's a little more Gerard Depardieu. Oh, goodness. Who is the guy who is in that movie with Phoebe Cates? The Imaginary Friend. Oh, God, what was his name?
Oh,
He just passed away. Drop Dead Fred?
Drop Dead Fred, yeah, thank you.
Yeah, what was his name?
I can't remember the guy who played...
He just died not too long ago.
Really?
Yeah, Rick Mayall. Oh, like someone with his type of energy. Yeah, Rick Mayall.
Oh yeah,
Blackadder. Totally. You know, he was in all that stuff. Like
wasn't he in this movie?
It would be so great. No, it's just there was a lot of.
There was a guy who looked like him in Last Starfighter.
He was doing movies in the early '80s. He was in a.
Huh.
He could have been there. He could have been in this, but. But no, it's just again. This is the thing where, post Star Wars, everybody who was noble had a British accent. Everybody who was a villain had a British accent. You know, we had this theatricality where Lucas would match like Shakespearean actors to nonsense, and it worked really well because you bought into it. But The Last Starfighter feels like it wants to be a sci-fi serial and it wants to be a cowboy movie, and it just doesn't work as well. That's not, you know, criticizing the movie, but if you feel like the heart's gone, the heart's not there. You know, and I think maybe we should talk about the story a little bit. So I don't know if you guessed this or not, but a lot of people have compared this movie to Ender's Game. They said, oh, it copies Ender's Game.
Okay.
No, Ender's Game came after The Last Starfighter. But in Ender's Game, you know, spoiler, the kids were tricked into playing a video game, but they were actually fighting a war. And The Last Starfighter is the exact opposite. The video game is being used to recruit Alex. Mm-hmm. So, you know, dejectively, because this is the hero's journey.
Yep.
But it's also, what do they call it? What's the opposite of the refusal of the call? That's what it's called.
Yeah.
Like, we need that. We need the hero to say, no, I'm not good enough. I don't want any part of this. We need, you know, oh, yeah, I'll come back. Because, you know, movie needs to happen. But, like, why do you come back?
Like, in Last Starfighter?
Yeah, like, that's the problem.
So they played it like, okay, if I stay here, they're going to come and get me and maybe, like, threaten the lives of, like, my girlfriend and my mom and my brother.
My trailer park
But
friends.
Then, like, but then he leaves it, and then the whole point is to trick them into thinking that he stays, so then they're going to come anyway.
Yeah.
So there's no real, like, reason for it. There's no catalyst, technically. It's not like in Star Wars where Uncle Ben or Uncle Owen and Aunt Beru get just destroyed. It's not that
they,
where you're like
they
okay,
do get well. They do get turned into crispy critters. Can we just say
that? Yeah, exactly. So it's not that. But I'm gonna bring this back around when we talk about Cloak and Dagger, because there's something in there that I think is an interesting. Take on the hero's journey.
Can I say something real quick before we go? Did you find that Cloak and Dagger was the better movie?
Oh my gosh, it's
yeah. Like I'm being honest. I'm just being honest.
I'm obsessed with this movie. I'm obsessed with it. It's one of the best kids movies I've ever seen. It's one of the best movies I've seen from the '80s period.
Yeah, it's pretty good. So
it's really really fun. I mean, it's like Jumanji fun. Like Jumanji is like to me the epitome of like good kids movies.
Well,
in the '90s, and then this is, and then Cloak and Dagger is like that.
Well, I've
never seen a better '80s kids movie.
Cloak and Dagger has something that Last Starfighter wants to have, but it cannot have, and it has pathos, and it has magical realism. Last Starfighter is a handful of very very good ideas, and very very good scenes, and very, very good actors.
Yeah.
And
good it delivers in like an osmosis type of way too. Like you're feeling, you're like, man, I just like this movie.
Yeah.
And it's not because like, you know, it's thrilling or it's whatever. It's just you like the presence of the movie, which I think is an interesting. I don't think we really have that type of stuff anymore because everything's so like blockbustery and stuff. Like it's hard
overbloated.
To find these days.
It's overbloated. We don't know anything about these people. We know nothing about their race. We know nothing about their almost nothing about their battle. We don't know what the stakes are. For a movie called The Last Starfighter, there's no star fighting in this movie up until the end. Like,
well, it's like in Star Wars. Even if you don't understand the world of Star Wars, it's fun to be in Star Wars. Even if you don't understand Lord of the Rings, it's fun to be in Lord of the Rings. If you don't understand Neverending Story, it's fun to be in Neverending Story.
Well,
we don't have that. It just doesn't happen anymore. The Lord of the Rings was like the last of those.
Well, kind of. We had Super Mario Brothers this year. Like, okay, if you think about
anime,
it, Super,
well, Super, about, like, straight anime.
Well, Super Mario Brothers is The Last Starfighter. It's a guy who was down on his luck. He's a plumber, can't get anything, nothing. Goes to a magical world, and he's a hero.
That's true.
Like,
that's
very true. Like, it could be a fever dream. It could be like a Jacob's Ladder where he got hit on the head, and he's imagining the whole thing. But
like the Bob Newhart show.
Well, he was on two different series, okay? That last episode wrapped everything up. It was a dream. It was Dynasty, okay? But for a whole series. By the way, if you don't know what we're talking about, watch Family Guy. It'll make sense. But
that's what it is.
Oh, the Family Guy did it in one of the most clever gags they've ever done, and that's saying something about Family Guy, clever. But they did a fever dream episode where they had real-life Rob Lowe and who played Batman in the 60s? Adam West. Mm-hmm. And they were taking a nap in their cartoonish pajamas, and Adam West has a nightmare. And he dreamed he was in Cartoon Land, and Rob Lowe said, "Don't worry, it's just a nightmare. Go back to sleep." And that was brilliant. That was pretty funny. So, but we have this fantasy land. I got to tell you something though. How much better would The Last Starfighter have been? How much better if Alex was like 13 and dweeby?
Yeah. I love Catherine Mary Stewart. So like,
yeah,
that wouldn't have worked.
Well, no, she was kind of hitting on his little brother. His little brother is swearing. He's saying shit. He's reading pornos.
He's probably my favorite character, honestly, is the brother. He's hilarious.
Yes. And we should say both of these movies have snarky little sidekicks. Yeah. And but his little brother though, he's reading porno magazines. Yeah. You know, he's doing all the stuff. He's friendly, he's got no job. Yeah. He's hitting on the girl. No, he's not hitting on her, but she might be a little some for him.
And the entire purpose of the porno magazines is so they can blackmail him because he sees what's happening and he says, "If you tell mom and dad if you tell mom I'm gonna tell her about your Playboys." And then he's like, goes back to sleep.
And then Beta Alex says the same thing. He says the same
thing. What's that?
Remember Beta Alex, the clone, says the exact same thing.
Oh, Beta Alex, yeah. Yeah. Beta Alex, yeah.
You know, it's funny. Lance Guest, before we forget, Lance Guest, the guy who, you know, the not Tom Cruise. He would spend, like, most of his career playing robots. Like, he was in those Disney Channel movies with Alan Thicke. He was in Not Quite Human. Like, they made, like, three of them.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Totally. Yeah, in, like, the late 80s, early 90s.
Yeah, but again, you can't have Tom Hanks and Tom Hulse and Lance Guest in the same universe. One of them has to go.
And I think... And Steve Guttenberg.
And Steve Guttenberg. Although, Guttenberg...
I love Guttenberg.
I do love him, too, but, you know what I mean? There are certain people who have a look, and that look does not transcend the decade. And then
totally.
I'm just being totally honest. And you know, you can't keep
great
that
80s actor though.
Exactly. Like there's a reason why they pop up in all these great movies, and then you never see them again. But but I will say this. Speaking of actors, I got to give the MVP of this movie to Dan O'Hurahy. Dan O'Hurahy. I love him. I love him in everything he's ever been in that I've seen him in. I love him. He's so much fun. He is what this movie should have been. And every time he's on the screen, he's in a different movie. Can we say that?
Yeah.
He's having a ball.
And, his laugh.
And, I mean, the smoker.
Wheezing laugh.
Yeah, the wheezing.
Oh, so good.
But he is playing, for those who don't know, if you don't think you know him, he played the old man in RoboCop.
You're
fired.
Also, the connection to John Carpenter is he was the owner of Shamrock in Halloween 3, the best Halloween, by the way.
Yeah, a lot of people don't give Halloween. That's the one with the glasses, right?
So good, yeah.
The glasses that
they have the mask that
melt
the kids' heads on Halloween. Oh, it's so Halloween 3 is a movie we got to talk about because that one is. Well, I think it's one of the most underrated 80s movies.
That's because it tried to do something really cool and really brave, where it was going to make it an anthology out of it, right? It was not about Michael Myers, but they had it happened with the Friday the 13th movies. They decided we have to, well, Freddy's doing it, so we're going to have to create a monster. And what do we have? And they brought back Michael Myers, and they turned it into something I don't think John Carpenter really appreciated very much. But he liked the paychecks.
It reads like a old an old Vault Comics horror comic, like a what Creepshow kind of tried to do. But it reads that's how the way the movie plays, and it's so perfect. Halloween 3 is perfect.
You know, there's one movie series that continued that cool trajectory and been successful with it. It was the Cloverfield movies, where every Cloverfield movie is different and disconnected.
Yeah,
but they're all
the show. I think didn't do too well, but I like the movies.
I mean, I guess an analog would be like Black Mirror or something, right?
But before.
But man, we could talk about anthology shows all day long and horror ones because they're great. But no, going back to this, though, but the concept is you have this kid, but the kid, and he's down on his luck. He just yearns to break free. You know, it's very Luke Skywalker without the dual sons. But like you said, in Star Wars, his aunt and uncle were conveniently fricasseed. Like, if they weren't burned to death, he'd still be on Tatooine doing nothing.
Yeah.
Oh, you're dead. I guess I can go. No baggage. But here, you love these characters. You love the trailer park people. They're just happy. You know, the mom, obviously she's overworked. Alex can't do anything in his own life because he has got to fix their toilets and television. But think about this, though, Ethan. Here's the problem with Last Starfighter. Here's the problem. Now, Alex is likable. The actor's likable, right? He's charming.
Mm-hmm.
But he's very good looking. Mm-hmm. He's got a hot girlfriend. Everybody likes him. He's brilliant. He's like, everybody's so bored when he beats the high score, they can't think of anything better to do than go and cheer him on. Like, it's the highlight of their day because they're bored. They live in a trailer park. He's got everything going on for him. He's well-liked. He's got friends. There's nothing wrong with his life. He lives in California. He lives in paradise.
Yeah, even the trailer park he's in is like the coolest trailer park
ever. The coolest trailer park. Everybody loves each other. Everybody's getting along, especially Otis. You know, by the way, can we talk about Otis for a second?
Yeah.
Vernon Washington.
Yeah.
I guess we got to say it. Like, the rules of problematic stuff. I love Otis. I love his character. But you don't see this character in movies anymore. This character has been erased from existence. And can we just say it? The wise old black soul. Like, you don't see this anywhere. You saw this.
The Uncle Remus.
Uncle Remus. What did a... Spike Lee called it the magical Negro character.
Was that what it was called? Magical Negro?
That's Spike Lee. That's Spike Lee.
Yeah, the Bagger Vance thing.
Bagger Vance, you know, Uncle Remus, that kind of thing. And he's the best person in the world. He's got wise old sage. Another character you don't see is the wise old Native American who makes everything better with a sweat lodge. Like, enchanting, like, Wishbringers. Like, you know what I mean? Like,
oh. Poltergeist 2.
Exactly. You know?
That's the, like, first thing I thought of is Poltergeist 2.
There's so, like...
Good movie, but by the way. I like Poltergeist 2.
Real corpses in that movie, too.
Yeah.
When you have a problem, you go to your Native American friend, and suddenly there's feathers, and there's chanting, and you're sweating, and you're reconnected with nature, and everything's perfect. It fixes everything. Yeah. Native American magic. But poor Vernon Washington. He's fun in this movie. Everyone loves him. You know, he's got profound things. You got to believe in yourself that he goes back in his trailer and he's probably watching porno. Like, there's nothing going on in this trailer park. Like, everybody's day is just, they exist to watch Alex fix things. And that's the problem with the movie, is that there's no characters, really. They're all stereotypes.
Yeah.
And that's a problem.
Yeah, I loved Catherine Mary Stewart. I think she's great in this. I think she's probably the most, like, dynamic of the characters.
Mm-hmm.
Other than, I mean, like, Dan O'Hurley, he's great, but like, again, he's not written great, really.
Great. It's a performance.
You know what I mean? His performance is great, but he's not. I think the only character that has, like, anything you can really kind of chew on is is Catherine Mary Stewart's character. What was her name? Maggie?
Maggie. Until the end, yeah. Though, it was like at the end when Alex...
Yeah, spoiler, they kind of just back, throw it, yeah.
Yeah, I'll go.
They
kind of
just
mom.
Phone it in. They phone it in, yeah. It's kind of rushed, but...
There's a couple times when Alex is egging her on, and Alex says, oh, together forever, right? Right? We're going to be together forever, right? And he comes back. He's like, hey, come with me. No, I don't want to go. Come on, we use it forever. He's guilting her into going into space and leaving. They're like, what about Granny?
Like, kids, don't let your boyfriend guilt you into going to space.
Look, here's a great quote. I got a quote from the movie. I was going to say it, but I recorded the line. So here's the best line in this movie. Ready? Here it goes. Here's the line.
Granny, put away that shotgun. What's wrong with you?
Yeah. Granny, put away that shotgun. What's wrong with you? Granny brings out that shotgun on a whim. She's got that shotgun cocked. Why? If the trailer park's so great, why does she need a shotgun for? But she's got it. She's got a shotgun. Yeah. Like, if this movie were different, the trailer park people would have been the ones to kill the alien invaders. They would have banded together, like Three Amigos or, you know, Bug's Life.
Yeah.
And they would have took out the alien son of a bitches.
Like Three Amigos or Bug's Life.
Yeah. By the way, one of those came first. There's what's that whole story meme based on? I know it's not Bug's Life, and I know it's not Three.
Oh, like the Western?
Yeah, it's not Seven Samurai, is it? I forget. Where they're all pretending
Like
to be
the, like the Magnificent Seven, basically. Is it? Yeah, like Seven Samurai, yeah.
I'll just say Bug's Life because that's what people remember. But
no, I just love that you mentioned Three Amigos and Bug's Life in the same sentence, really.
Well, someone had to do it, you know. Yeah. But no, it's just, you know, there you see this movie and it feels like such a great template for a better movie.
Yeah, it's fun though.
Oh, it's like, a fun movie. I like it.
And it's like I would watch it again. And it's my favorite part was when he said she stuck her tongue in my ear and I screamed. And I'm just imagining that happening.
She called.
I laughed out loud.
You don't. They never explain it, but apparently she stuck her tongue in his ear, and she got offended because he called her a sex maniac or sex. Or
yeah,
something.
Yeah, exactly.
But we go back into the whole thing though. The idea is that you have a boy who yearns to be free. He's great at something, and it turns out that one thing he's really great at can save the universe. And and I said this in my notes, and I'm going to say that this is the best thing I can say about this movie. This is the movie that Andy from Toy Story would have watched to like Buzz Lightyear.
Ooh, yeah.
And when we were...
And it's not Lightyear from 2020?
No. Well, actually, I have some proof for it, because... Clearly, this movie is beloved by people. Like, people, maybe they're not in love with the movie, but they love the idea. Because the idea is great. The idea is perfect. It's like Groundhog's Day. It's like Star Wars. The idea is solid. It just, and so, when you watch Toy Story, now, if you watch Lightyear, you've seen Lightyear, right?
Yeah.
Lightyear is mediocre in all the bad ways, because it does not live up to its central premise. The central premise is that Lightyear is supposed to be the movie that small Andy watched that made him Buzz Lightyear crazy. But I don't know what universe you live in, but in no metaverse would a five-year-old boy get excited about Space Rangers, a Space Ranger that featured intergenerational lesbian couples. It's not happening.
The movie was so blatantly 2022 that it was not...
It is not Steel Magnolias, right? It is not, it is not like... Fried green tomatoes. Like, you cannot have that in a children's movie. Now, this, on the other hand, you can see it, can't you?
Yeah.
It's so playing good. The game.
Yeah, it's fun. And it's too, like you were saying, like, oh, there's nothing really driving, making... It's not believable that he wants to leave the trailer park because the trailer park's so fun and, like, you want to be there. But also, like, if they made the trailer... On the other hand, if they made the trailer park look... seedy and gross. Yeah. It's like that wouldn't have been. Yeah. I rather this version. You know.
No, this is this. Yeah, because this is the closest analog would be like the decrepit building in like what was that movie? Batteries Not Included. Like, you know what I mean? Where all the old people get along, even though they live in a slum.
Yeah, you know? Like it's the movie that it should. The movie that it could very easily turn into is a worse movie, I think.
Well, check this out. I'm going to play you two clips, and you tell me what these clips have in common. And you're as soon as you hear it, you're going to smile. Okay, ready for this?
Yeah.
Here's a clip. This one's 20 seconds, but you listen to the whole thing. Here we go. Listen carefully.
Okay. So, where are you from? Singapore? Hong Kong?
Well, no. Actually, I'm stationed up in the Gamma Quadrant of Sector 4. As a member of the elite, Universe Protection Unit of the Space Ranger Corps. I protect the galaxy from the threat of invasion from the evil Emperor Zurg, sworn enemy of the Galactic Alliance.
Oh, really? I'm from Play School, and I'm from Mattel.
Yeah, you know where that movie's from, right?
Of course, yeah.
Okay.
Toy Story.
Now, this is from Last Starfighter. Listen to this.
Greetings, Starfighter. You have been recruited by the Star League to defend the frontier against Zur and the Kodan Armada.
Yeah.
Get ready. Prepare for blastoff.
Yep, the Emperor Zur.
I thought that, too, when I was watching it. It sounded like Zurg, for sure. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. The idea that you have this fantastic space ranger, and you're going to go fly in the sky, and you're going to have adventures, and everything's cool. That's The Last Starfighter. That's all it is.
That's like, a good take. Wow. I guess I connected Zurg and Zorg or whatever.
Well, that's a homonym.
I bet they were thinking to have this movie least in the back of their minds.
I'm sure they thought they were going to sell toys. It was going to be a Star Wars hit. It just doesn't have that oomph that Star Wars has. It doesn't cross the finish line in such the same way.
It's destined to be a cult favorite 35 years later, 40 years later.
That's the thing, though, is something in 80s films that we don't, and we can move on from Last Starfighter here in a second, because I think we both like the movie quite a bit. We just don't love it. Just don't love it. Or love the execution of it. Can I say that?
Yeah.
But you don't need everything explained. And I think we've talked about this before, and that's really the sin of 21st century film in general, especially these IP-driven things. Everything that Disney sort of collects in its black hole gets turned into one of these, where you need a prequel to explain why. Like, why this character did this? How did this character do this? What happened to this? How did this character get to be? Everything needs to be explained. Like, how did Han Solo get his name? How did they get the dice? What happened here? What happened there? Like, there is no mystery because some fan fiction became canon, and that's it. You know, everything became... And now we're in a new phase where everything's the metaverse. So nothing matters anymore. Like, if you don't like it, don't worry. There's another universe. We just start over. You want Michael Keaton Batman? He's back. You miss Andrew Garfield? Don't worry. He and Tobey Maguire are back again. You know, you're going to have this version. You're going to have that version. Everybody's here. Don't worry. Nothing matters because everything matters.
And everyone gets a trophy.
Yeah, it's boring. It's very boring. In some ways, the lack of identity in Last Starfighter is what makes it so beloved. There is no explanation on almost... Yeah. Like, they're telling you that... what's his name? Goodness gracious. We just mentioned him. Centauri?
Yeah.
He created the video game? No, he did not. That fool, he did not create this video game. He's got those fake eyes. He looks like a dinosaur.
It doesn't matter. But that's the thing. It doesn't even matter. Like, this is a movie. Okay, here's an 80s movie that does try to explain everything and I think fails because of it. Tron. Mm-hmm. And I love Tron. But it explains too much. And I think it's an obtuse movie because of it. But if you really watch it a couple times and you really are understanding what's going on, it's brilliantly conceived. And whoever was in charge of writing this movie, I forget the name of the writer and even the director, but they were way ahead of their time, and the stuff that they were talking about was decades some of it ahead of what people could even conceive of, fathom what these things meant. But at the same time, it's impenetrable in some regard.
Well,
whereas The Last Starfighter doesn't really explain much, but there's some lore happening, but it's also it's very accessible.
Well, you know, it's funny. Speaking of Tron, they keep going back to that well. And, you know, they did a reboot sequel years ago with from the director of Top Gun, Maverick, actually.
Yeah.
You know, but no, it's a good-looking film, but that movie...
It's good. It's a fun one. Yeah.
It's fun, but most people remember, like, the Daft Punk soundtrack from it.
Yeah, it's got great production design, and it has a really, really good palette.
And it was visually arresting. Like it tried to de-age. Goodness great! Why can't I remember anybody's
Jeff
name?
Bridges.
Jeff Bridges. Yeah. You know, not successfully, but it tried.
That was one of the first ones too.
There's a sequel coming out. They're making a third one, and
really,
it's got the mark of death on it because it stars Jared Leto.
So,
I think it's called Tron Ares. So it's coming out. It's supposed to come out like next year, or the year after, but. That's the thing. Like, they're going to keep trying because they have the IP. They're going to keep trying and trying and trying. And we're going to explain more. And that's really the missing ingredient, I think, Ethan, is that you need to let the audience make up their own adventures. You know, you need to let them figure it out. You need to let them, you know, suppose, you know, a million reasons why. And if you take that away from them, you, there's no reason for them to ever watch the movie again. You've done your, you've done their dreaming for them, and it's boring. You know, it's very boring. And The Last Starfighter is a lot of things, but it's never boring. Like, no, it comes, it does its thing. It's, it, again, it's called, it's got, it's a video game. It's got plot armor. Alex is never going to die. Like, you know, like I said, you have all these really interesting characters that don't really have anything to do except for pontificate from the bridge. Like, there's that one alien creature that I put, you know, the one we die. Like, they have a cool design, but all that, that guy's got the little visor around his eye that does nothing. He's like, okay, now I'm going to talk. Like, you don't, you're not doing anything. You're not flying a ship. You're not walking. You're just talking. You have cool makeup, but that's all you have. You look cool. And everyone else is bald. So... it's just, what are you supposed to do? Like, who wants to buy a toy of a girl with male pattern baldness? Who wants to buy that?
Who wants to buy a toy with a guy with male pattern baldness?
Daddy, it looks like you. You know, it's like all your favorite characters. Lord Krill, Zur, you know, friendly alien. There's also that scene that...
I want a Burt Young action figure.
Oh, God. You know, is he alcoholic wife-beating Burt Young, or is he lovable scamp Burt Young from Rocky IV on with the robot?
The 80s robot.
But by the way, that robot was edited out of the new version of Rocky IV.
Yeah, that's what you were saying.
Yeah, I don't know if I like that.
Best part of the movie.
Look, Polly was having a relationship with that robot, okay? You don't take that away. Polly's got nothing in his life. He's got nothing.
He's take away the robot.
He's got no talents. He's an alcoholic. He beats his sister on Thanksgiving. He's got nothing going for him. You take away his robot. So screw that. But no, it's I mean, we could talk about Last Starfighter. I mean, I will say this. Great soundtrack. Very catchy.
Yeah.
You know, and who was it? I have one more thing to say about this, and we could talk about it later. There's a writer out there named Gary Whitta, who I think I follow him on Twitter, or he follows me, or somebody follows somebody. Probably me follow him, because I don't mean anything to him. He used to be a games journalist. He used to actually write about video games, and he switched over to screenwriting. And you've seen the movies he's done. He's done big films. He did The Book of Eli. He did After Earth, and he is the guy in charge of rebooting The Last Starfighter, and he is giving it his all. And a couple of years ago, like a year and a half ago, he released a demo reel of the film with the writer, who is the original writer. And it shows production art. It has the score remastered. And the movie is called The Last Starfighters. And they're doing that S thing that, you know, that...
he's adding S.
He's adding S because it adds something. Well, it didn't work with Predators. So,
yeah.
But, no, I don't know. We'll see. For those who want to see it, just look up Gary Whitta, Last Starfighter on YouTube, and you'll see the sizzle reel. You'll see the production art. You'll see this. They got some new music in there. I hope it never happens. I don't want any more Last Starfighter.
I didn't realize the guy who did Book of Eli did After Earth, because one of them was like a Scientologist, and the other one is a like Christian.
Well, he also did. He also worked on Rogue One, so he's got a little Star Wars in him. But but no, I mean, like I said, I say this here. I don't want a sequel to this movie. If you're really going to do it, reboot it. Reboot it. It's got all the material for it. He's got, like I said, you make Alex younger, make him dweeby and nerdy. Because every time they have these video game heroes, they're always good-looking kids. You cannot have that. Like, Ready Player One? Like, why are you disappearing from your life? You got everything going for you. What you have to be, you have to be fat. You have to look like the kid from Bad Santa, right? You got to be disgusting.
Thurman Merman.
Yeah, you got to be disgusting, right? you got to escape from the real world because your real world sucks.
Or younger, you have to be like 13.
Maybe. Yeah, 13 or something, dweeby, you know, you have to be alone in the world. You got no friends. People bully you in school because you're a nerd, because you're smart, or you have autism. You know, it's kind of what was that other robot movie? Daryl? Remember? I think Daryl.
I have not seen Daryl, but I definitely know it.
Man, the 80s were wild. Like, they would not do that today. But but speaking of movies they would never make today, let's be clear.
I don't think they could make this today.
This movie's not happening today. And to be fair, when we discussed pairing this, I think it came down to two films. It came down to Cloak and Dagger, which won.
Yeah.
And War Games with Matthew Broderick.
Yeah, came out a year before.
Yeah, and War Games and Cloak & Dagger have a lot in common.
Yeah, I think those two could be paired even.
You could pair it.
Yeah.
But it was just a roll of the dice, and yeah. We picked Cloak & Dagger. And I'll be honest with you, great choice, because I had a lot of fun revisiting. I had not watched this movie in some years. And yeah. This movie has been forgotten by a lot of people. And I don't know if that's intentional or it's been like repressed because of how violent it is in certain places. Mm-hmm. This is the most violent children's movie meant for children I've ever seen. Like, this movie was designed for little kids to go see. And there is a scene in the movie, which we can talk about later, where the bad guy is threatening to mutilate and torture.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Not just, and he's doing it happily. And there's several instances of adults trying to shoot children, like multiple times.
And then there's like the one where Murray gets like a literal hole in it, like his eye is just blown out.
Yeah, it's and
chilling
then he's
in the trunk.
Yeah, then he's gonna hide with a corpse.
Weird.
So let's.
It's brilliant.
So can you synopsize Cloak & Dagger?
Yeah, I'll try.
You love this so much, so synopsize.
So basically, this is a movie where a young boy, very imaginative boy, it's kind of like a Boy Who Cried Wolf type of situation where...
That's the name of the story it was based off of, too, by the way.
Yeah, he's always making up stories. He's really into, like, role-playing games, like D&D type of stuff, although they don't call it that. But he's into video games, too, and he hangs out with his friend, who's a girl, and then he also hangs out with his older guy, Murray, at his video game store. And he goes out on a quest to get a catalog from a video game company, because that's what they did back then. And at this building where the catalog is retrieved, he witnesses a murder.
Mm-hmm.
And then the body disappears when the cops come. And he's like, no, I just saw the body. The men disappeared. Nobody knows what happened. Nobody believes the kid. His dad doesn't believe him, who's played by Dabney Coleman brilliantly.
In one of his two roles in the film.
Yeah, yeah. And then he also has an invisible friend named Jack Flack,
mm-hmm.
which if you don't have subtitles on, sounds like Jack Black.
Yeah, I thought so, too.
And so basically it kind of turns into a North by Northwest a little bit, meets, it's very Hitchcockian. There's also elements, I don't know if you've ever seen The Lady Vanishes. It's a 1938 Hitchcock movie, maybe. It's Hitchcock's best.
Well, this director, Richard Franklin, has been... like very vocal that he loves Alfred Hitchcock. Like he's his favorite director.
Well, that makes total sense. Have you seen if you haven't seen The Lady Vanishes, watch it. It's the most underrated Hitchcock movie. So good.
Don't forget, he's also the director of Psycho 2. Like he was the guy actually a good sequel.
Yeah, it's a good sequel.
Yeah.
So I mean this guy's got Hitchcock everywhere. It's very espionage-y, and Hitchcock did that I think better than anything. Better than anyone even. It's really good. It's thrilling, really. And
it's never not dangerous. Can we say that? It's always on edge.
He's kind of trying to figure, and simultaneously from trying to escape these guys, he's also kind of trying to piece together portions of a mystery. Like another one I was thinking of was The Man Who Knew Too Much with James Stewart, another Hitchcock movie. Reminiscent of that a little bit too. But I loved it. This is why Jumanji is my favorite 90s movie, because it kind of walks that tightrope between scary and adventurous and really not super high stakes, but still really high stakes as it comes to be. But Cloak & Dagger, there's a definite innocence that still kind of needs to be present in any family film, and it's still there. Like, the kid isn't just – he's not Macaulay Culkin, right? He's not Kevin, whatever his last name is, he's Kevin McAllister. He's very innocent. He has this real earnestness to him, and he doesn't say bad words. He doesn't. And if this was in the 90s, when he escapes from the bad guys at any point, he'd like stick his tongue out or smile. But this kid plays it straight. Henry Thomas plays it straight. He gets away from the bad guy. When he makes his escapes, he's like, whew, okay, he's on to the next chapter. And I think that this would have played a lot differently if it were made even 8 years later.
It needed to happen exactly when it did. It was a perfect temperature for these type of films and this type of performance. Henry Thomas is perfect. This might be his best performance in a film.
Yeah, like, he's really good.
Like, he's great in E.T., don't get me wrong, but this is different. In E.T., he had no dad. In this one, he has a dad, but the dad's always at work because that's how it happens.
No mom. Yeah.
Let me say something about this. So the basic plot is that, like you said, he loves video games. He loves his Atari. And the video cartridge, by the way, back in the day, we called them tapes. I just want to let you know. If it was Atari, we called it tapes. Yeah. I think it's a holdover from cassette tapes, but whatever. We called them tapes, so that's just, that's the rule. So that's the
8-track tape too, right? Yep,
that's the nomenclature. That's what you got to say. And when he finds it, he plays that this, you know, the idea is great, actually. The video game is hiding some spy plans, we'll just say that. And and they want to get him back.
It's almost a MacGuffin. It's like a MacGuffin, too.
Exactly.
Right?
Like, you do see the MacGuffin, but if you think about the intricacies of how everything has to go down, especially, which we could talk about later, the big reveal of who the baddies are, the real baddies, none of it makes sense. Yeah, none of it makes sense.
Yeah.
But it's chilling and it's scary. And that's what I want to talk about the 1980s as it pertains to this film. I grew up during the 80s. I grew up a little bit during this era, so I can tell you some of this is true. I love the fact that they show the kids on their own all the time. You see Davey and Meg, you know, they're really good friends, even though they're about 10. They're hanging out at the comic book video game store. That's true. We did that.
Yeah.
Because no one thought the man giving you comics was going to touch you. No one thought that. It probably happened a lot, but no one thought it. And the parents said, oh, at least you have a friend. He's 30 and he's single and he wants you to go home and play with his joystick.
Bad.
Yeah. But you know what? You're all he's got. So the kids are precocious, but they're autonomous. They're not stupid. And they show them going, and they show them strategizing. They show them going on the bus, showing their bus pass, trying to negotiate. These kids are intelligent. That's very important because it establishes that this world is perfectly fine with a 6-year-old girl taking the bus to the airport at 11:45 p.m. and no one gives a shit. Like, I'm going to get on this plane by myself. Like, and
the taxi driver who takes Henry Thomas, I'll take you.
Yeah, I'll take you after you bribed him. Oh,
like if that were now, I'd be like, I do not want anyone to get the wrong idea.
There is multiple instances of grown men chasing this child through crowded city, like the famous
the Riverwalk.
The Riverwalk in San Antonio. Yeah, I have friends who've been there.
Can I say too the location use in this in this movie is awesome. I've been to San Antonio.
Yeah, you can recreate about it. You 10 can
years
recreate
ago.
It. Yeah.
And it looks like, and when I went 10 years ago in 2012, it looked like how it looked. And that was 30 years after this film was released almost. And it looked still like this, like the patterns on the walkway were the same. The umbrellas were the exact same. He said something in the boat tour. And I remember as soon as he said it was like deja vu. The script was the same when I went on the boat tour.
The Japanese garden, right? Is that still
the Japanese garden? Yeah. You could see the Tower of America is in the background. They go to the Alamo, although the inside, I think, was recreated.
Well, they get off locations in the city. Like, it feels and they picked it because that's where Henry Thomas is from.
Yeah. Oh, it's so good. And again, like Last Starfighter is really good at locations, but it's one location. And he uses it really, really well. In this one, he almost never repeats. The only places he repeats are the house and the mall. And the store at the mall. And he goes to different portions of the Riverwalk because Riverwalk's huge. But, like, he never really repeats a location more than once. And it's so good.
And he spends, like, he's like, it's almost like Harvey with Jimmy Stewart. Like, he spends the movie with Dabney Coleman as his friend.
Yeah. But
he's by himself. Like, you know, so, but this is what happened in the 80s. That's why I say latchkey kids, because this happened. Like, we used to go bike riding, we used to go to the mall by ourselves. Like, I'm not trying to say that things were better, we were less protected. It's just that's just the temperature of the world at the time, that your parents thought you need to be out with your friends. We weren't quite absorbed by video games as much, or computers. There's no social networks or social media, none of that stuff. It was, you want to play a video game, you got to go to the arcade. You got to go to the mall, because that's how you played adult. You went to the mall with your friends. $5 could last you all day if you were smart, but you that was your social life. That was your social network. Your social network was, you know, let's go to Babbage's, then we'll go to Orange Julius, then we'll go down to the Adidas store, we'll hang out at the pet store, then, you know, we'll get home by 6. Because we have bus passes, and we're children of the 80s, we can do what the hell we want, no one cares, because no one's home with dinner. Because we have one parent.
The Wizard was kind of like that, too. Like,
yeah, exactly like that.
I bet that was very much, I mean, that was 4 years after this came out, I think. I'm sure it had this on its brain when they were making The Wizard.
Well, that's what I'm saying, though. Like, actually, I see elements of this plot all over the place. Like, I saw the trailer for the new Blue Beetle movie, and
oh yeah,
that's exactly Cloak and Dagger. Like, he's in the building cleaning it, and this, you know, the person goes, oh, hide this. Oh, and he brings it home, he comes to Blue Beetle. That's the cartridge. Like, the idea is that you get embroiled in someone else's shenanigans, right? Or like Innerspace with Martin Short and Dennis Quaid. You know, you become embroiled in someone else's adventure. Now you have to figure your way out of it. But the idea that the main character is going to be a 10-year-old orphaned boy whose father is absentee and his mother's dead, and he has to, you know, he retreats into his own world. And it turns out, because like you said, he cries wolf so much that no one believes him when he tells him he witnessed a murder. Like, would you believe a 10-year-old if they said they witnessed a murder?
Yeah, I know. And that's what you think, too. They never kind of – they never alienate Davey. They always have characters who witness it and are on the set. You know what I mean? It's not frustrating. Like, oh, why is no one believing him? It's not that, because Kim sees it. There's a couple other characters who kind of see it along the way. But at the same time, you can see where the dad's coming from. He isn't a dick.
Nice. He's a good dad.
He's very sweet. He wants to relate to his son. They have that fight, and then instantly, you know, there's like a moment, and then they kind of, she's like, ah, can I sleep in your bed tonight? Okay. And they kind of like joke or whatever. The relationship between them is very sweet, even though there is some tension with the mother being dead. Dad has to work. He's a military guy. He's probably working 13-hour days, it seems like. He's still working at
11 o'clock at night. But think about this, though. When he imagines Jack as his father.
Yeah.
Like, that's the big, like, you know, when you're a kid, you don't really put that together. But, of course, you know, maybe they should have revealed it a little differently in the movie. It would have had more impact. But, you know, Dabney Coleman, the great Dabney Coleman, who's amazing in this, by the way, he plays the best friend. He plays the imaginary friend, who's this basically James Bond surrogate / I can do anything because Davey controls him and he can live vicariously. But, you know, it's funny. Same relationship as the movie Jojo Rabbit. You know, remember Jojo Rabbit, where Hitler's his best friend, you know, his imaginary friend, you know, which is different. But, you know, you see elements in that. I mean, it's no more inappropriate there than it was here. It's the context of the film, and it makes perfect sense that this kid would imagine, you know, he would have this imaginary double life. Yeah.
And I love when that he says, how do I drive the car? Like, what do I do? And I was wondering if the conscience, because it's him, the imaginary friend, would tell him what to do. But he said, I don't know. Like, because he's like, it's him still.
Exactly.
It's still the kid. He's not going to know how to drive the car. But yeah, there are some moments where it kind of toes that line, I guess. But
I will say this, though. I think the most controversial part of this movie, and I say that, you know, fleetingly. It's not like no one's hating this movie because of it.
Yeah.
Is the nudge, nudge, wink, wink at the end during the pivotal scene. You know what I'm talking about. I did not want to clip a lot of this movie. I think you and I both wholeheartedly recommend it. We can still talk about it quite a bit. But I have one thing that we need to address, and that is the violence. And the violence in
this
movie.
You're talking about the gun scene or the...
Many gun scenes. I will say this. When I was a kid, the scene that really got me is when she took off her glove, one of the bad guys, and she had she had that claw hand without the fingers.
That's creepy. Yeah. I got chills. I watched it when I watched this movie for this podcast. I got chills when that happened. I kind of saw it happen. I was like, oh, she's gonna be the one. I was gonna be her. She's gonna be the lady with the fingers. And it still happened, and I got chills when it happened. I was like, wow, that was a cool reveal.
And we will say this. We will preface this with a spoiler when we talk about those characters. Because I'll be honest with you, I don't think a lot of people have seen this film, and I would really hope if they listen to this, they go back and listen and watch it, and they enjoy it as much as we did. But let's just give our little trigger warning, literally, because it involves triggers. There's a lot of violence in this movie, and there's a lot of violence towards children. And I want to stress this, Ethan. There's no way of saying this. This movie was made for kids.
Yeah.
Like, this was a made-for-children movie, and it features multiple instances of children being shot at and threatened. And in some cases, threatened with mutilation. And so I have one clip here from the film. It's a little long, but bear with me. You know the scene I'm talking about. Towards the end, when Davey gets confronted by one of the terrorists, and they have this dialogue that I can't imagine happening today. I just can't do it. I cannot do it. So I'll let the terrorist speak for himself. Here's my only clip from Cloak and Dagger. Here we go.
Don't come any closer, or I'll shoot.
Sure you will. Red ink. Only this one shoots real bullets.
I'm warning you, this is not a water pistol.
Neither is this. I could turn you into shredded meat in about 3 seconds with this baby if I wanted to. But you've been a real pain in the neck, so I'm not going to be that nice. You know what I'm going to do to you, boy? I'm going to blow both your kneecaps off. It won't kill you, but it'll hurt worse than any dying you can imagine. Then you know what I'm going to do to you? Huh?
Shoot him, Davey. Shoot him.
I'm going to shoot you in the stomach. And then when you beg for me to finish the job, I won't do it. I'm just going to watch you die. Slowly.
Shoot. Pull the trigger.
Please stop. I don't want to shoot you.
But I want to shoot you.
Okay. There we go. That's not.
It is written by the guy who made Child's Play and Fright Night.
Yeah, we haven't even talked about this, have we? Tom Holland, not Tom Holland, not Spider-Man. Tom Holland, very different guy. No, this is the Tom Holland who would go off to create iconic. Speaking of iconic franchises, I would say the victor of all the 1980s horror icons. I think he won. I think Chucky won. They're still making Chucky stuff, and it's still popular.
Yeah. They got that shit. He's got it back now too. So
does he have it back?
Yeah, he's involved a lot.
Oh, nice.
Right now, so.
But he also did another amazing 1980s horror movie. He did Fright Night. And have you seen Fright Night?
Oh yeah, I love Fright Night.
Yeah, the original, and you know the remake's not terrible. The remake's not terrible. It's got.
I've never seen the sequel. I've seen the remake, but never Fright Night 2.
Nah, there's no reason. No, Fright Night's amazing. Fright Night is awesome. And the remake, not bad. Not bad. You know, not the greatest, but not bad. But no, he's done a lot of Stephen King stuff, too. But there's pathos in here. You know, we talked about this, and The Last Starfighter does not have this at all. It is sterilized, right? Yeah. Even when you see characters die and get incinerated, they might as well be looking at a Lincoln log. Like, there's no emotion in anything. Oh, yeah, you know, he tried to shoot me. Yeah, you know, yeah, whatever. He's dead now. So he just go to space, shoot people. This is pathological. Like, you feel terrified. If you're Davey, you feel terrified. Like, you're in real danger. Adults want to not just kill you. They want to really kill you. I'm going to shoot your kneecaps off.
And the scene when he's on the boat the first time around and the gentleman is after him and he kind of standing up and he's moving closer to him, and you're like, man, if this was now, all you'd have to say was, this guy's trying to hurt me, and everyone would be like, you know, it would be, especially in Texas,
or they would notice Texas, they would notice a giant man trundling after a small boy.
So that that part I don't know if that how that would have happened back then, but now though that would have not flown.
And he does that, too, in the movie at the airport when he, you know, to the bad guys, where he says, oh, that your mom and dad.
That was a good beat right there when he said that. And I was like, whoa, that's a good way to get him. Because then the TSA guys, okay, we got to figure out what's happening here. Like, something weird's up, like, kind of stifles it a little bit.
That's the old days, man. How much shit did you have to get down in an airport in 1984? You had to bring out a gun to get TSA after you.
Yeah.
You could swear, threaten bomb threats. You could smoke cigarettes. They let underage children in. Like, you have to steal someone's gun to get noticed.
Yeah. Now, even if you're five and you say there's a bomb on that plane, they will shut it down.
Yeah, you're on a no-fly list.
They will make sure that there is no bomb on that plane. Yeah. They will check everyone's bags. They will keep you there for 8 hours. Yeah, but back then, it's like, okay.
You know what, though? No terrorist acts. Be honest with you. People could bring on fried chicken. Yeah. No terrorist acts. You know, didn't have to take your shoes off. Didn't have to get patted down on the crotch. You know, but you know, it's funny that the chase scene. I actually put this there too. The chase scene. The scary part is that happens during the day, in a crowded area, and he is asking for help. Nobody's helping him. He's running. They're trying to kill him in the open in a crowded.
It made
space.
It scarier too, because you're like, wow, like no. It's one thing if he's like in a parking garage or, you know, in an alleyway. It's okay. That's creepy, but it's not. It doesn't really affect you on like a visceral level. It's more of just it's stressful.
And that happens too, by the way. We do get the darkened alley. We do get that too later.
Yeah,
but
and that's effective in its own right. But this is a different aspect of stress. It's not the same corners of your nerves as the parking garage, which is nerve-wracking. And so there's like different elements to this that gets peeled back, and I think that the Richard Franklin, the director who directs it, I think he does a brilliant job of never returning to the same trick, and everything is a different trick, and the twist is this, and he introduces the old people early on, and by the way, they were in both of them are married.
Oh, yes.
They're in Psycho too.
Yes.
Different. Yeah. One of them played a cop, I think, and the other one is the voice of Norman Bates. You can hear it.
We should say that. We should say the old couple. Like spoilers, if you haven't watched the film,
yeah.
Pause. Okay, pause because this is actually a genuine spoiler.
Yeah.
Welcome back. So you watch the film, you'll love it. So, the real villains turn out to be the kindly old couple on the boat.
Yeah.
Don't ask me why they're there, but they're there. You know, it doesn't make any sense, but you don't think about it.
It's almost like they're keeping an eye on the henchmen a little bit, like undercover.
Yep, and they're very kindly. They're very nice to him. They trick him. Eunice and George MacReady, right?
Yeah.
And like you said, they're actually an old married couple that have acted many, many times on television and movies together.
Together, yeah.
Yeah, and they look really nice, and they look really, you know, I want to make you cookies. You're just old folks. And then quite the opposite, can we just say this? They're both from the same era, you know, speaking of The Last Starfighter. Yeah. They're both from the same exact era as Robert Preston, but their acting has been upgraded to sinister.
Yeah.
Like, let's just say really that, like, good, yeah. They are very evil, evil people, and they are scary. And when she takes off her glove and she's got those fingers, that's disgusting.
She's smiling. Yeah.
And she's swearing. Not swearing, but, you know, she's rough.
Yeah.
That scene in the car where she takes the chloroform out and just knocks him out, that's terrifying.
Yeah.
Like, you're in trouble, kid. And then you just get put in a trunk. So, you know, that scene when he's listening to the bad guys, and they're not saying, hey, what do you want to do with the kid? You want to get rid of him? No, they're saying, we're going to kill the kid. They're saying, we should get paid extra for killing this child. That's what they say. They say, killing the child.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I think this is it's a brilliantly done movie. I think it's a shame that no one talks about it, because I think it's not only just a nostalgia trip. I never watched this movie before. I watched it and I was like, this is one of the most well done 80s movies. It's not even just it's fun. Like a thrilling. It's really well done. It's smart. And the director has his finger on the pulse of what the movie's doing at all times.
It's because
he's trying new things. It feels kind of like a James Gunn, what James Gunn would do with it if he had it now.
I'll say this. He's trying to remake North by Northwest.
Yeah.
You know, that's what he's doing.
It's kind of more entertaining than North by Northwest.
Well, I mean, North by Northwest has a movie that has all the problems of Last Starfighter in the special effects department. Like, it's an effects-heavy movie, but...
Yeah, it's probably my least favorite Hitchcock movie, and I've seen a lot of them.
But the ideas are so good. Like, that's the thing.
The photography is iconic. I mean, you have how many iconic scenes in that movie?
And you have Cary Grant giving, like, an amazing performance.
Yeah, and
so,
he's great, yeah.
And that's...
It's relative to Hitchcock. It's not my favorite Hitchcock. It's still better than what anyone else would do with it.
It's no Strangers on a Train. You know, it's not Crisscross.
Well, yeah, that's a good movie,
I'm sorry, Throw Mama from the Train.
Oh, yeah. I thought you were going to say Strangers on a Train is a good movie.
No, Strangers on the Train. I was actually making a joke. Like, if you remake Hitchcock, you remake it as a comedy with Danny DeVito and that old woman from Goonies.
Yeah, Throw Mama from a Train, yeah. Got it, yeah.
And by the way, going back to 80s stuff real quick, I mean, there's really only so much we can talk about this without spoiling anymore, but that's really the movie. It's the tension it creates. There are very few kids' movies from the 80s that have that type of real visceral damage. Like, you can die even though you're a child, or there's something scary or traumatic. Goonies comes close, I think, in certain ways. Like, Goonies has moments when you feel terrified that the terrorists are going to kill the kid, especially with a Chunk and the deformed brother, remember, with the rocky road?
Mm-hmm.
Like, but they turn it around and make it funny.
Sloth.
Yeah, Sloth.
Well, and also, Stand By Me gets there in a different way. Mm-hmm. Like, it talks about the death. It talks about this kid who was killed. And so, like, that has a reality to it in its own right, but you don't feel like the characters are threatened, but there is, like, a reality to that I think kids weren't used to watching.
You're right. I mean, you're actually, like, you know, the director, he's a huge fan of Stephen King. He's made Stephen King projects, too. Like, but Stand By Me is itself a movie we could talk about, and I think we could get a lot out of it as well. I think it's one of Rob Reiner's best films, and I think it's...
And he has a lot of good ones.
He has a lot of good ones between like 1980 and 1989. Like,
yeah.
And then that.
Pretty much, all of them in the 80s were great.
Yeah, he was a
good one. He had one good one in the 90s. I can't remember which one.
The American President, I think.
Yeah. That was Aaron Sorkin, yeah?
Yeah. Like, he just, you could tell, like, something happened to him. I don't know what happened to Rob Reiner, but he was basically like a Spielbergian director.
Yeah. Oh, he was flawless. I mean, yeah, everything he did. Harry Met Sally,
A Few Good Men.
Yeah, well, that's 92.
Princess Bride,
Spinal Tap,
yeah. And let's be honest, he's a funny guy when he's not crazy, he's funny. Like,
yeah.
I actually went back and I had a little extra time, and I actually went back and went through all the All in the Family.
It
holds up in the same way I think these movies holds up. And I guess this is where I'm going to sort of end my analysis of it, is these movies are dated. Can we just say that? They are time capsules, but they're time capsules, especially Cloak and Dagger. It's a time capsule in a way that I think enhances the movie. This is a movie that was made during a time of which it could be made. Like, you had this like release. I think you understand what I'm talking about. In the 1970s, you had all these directors, you had all these filmmakers that felt freedom. They weren't bound by so many censorial boards. They could do whatever they wanted.
The new wave.
And in the 1970s, you had all these dirty, gross, grimy, like disgusting, like adult films. You had nudity. Didn't need it, but you had it. You had violence. Didn't need it, but you had it. You had stories that could never be told like this before. It wasn't, hey, you suckers, I'm gonna plug you. No, you had real people talking real language. Yeah. And meanwhile, and I think you agree, meanwhile, you could have all the violence and the sex, but you also had characters sitting down and talking, and you had philosophical discussions. You had adult themes. I don't think Last Starfighter has that. I don't think it. I think it's missing those themes. But Cloak and Dagger has those themes.
Yeah.
And I think it. Can we talk about the final scene? Not the horrible green screen. Okay. Which, by the way, the worst green screen I've ever seen.
That is the worst part of it. That's the only negative thing you could say about this movie.
Let me put it this way. There's a green screen with an explosion, and they show Dabney Coleman. And first of all, he's in a shadow. If you're walking in front of a fireball, you're not in a shadow.
He's not even running out of it. No. He's like just sauntering of the smoke.
But the green screen is running at like a very different frame rate. And then when you actually see Dabney Coleman and Harry Thomas, the film actually starts like stuttering. It's because you could tell there's no ending, so it just starts steady. It starts stuttering, and eventually it just crashes. And like, it didn't end. And a lot of movies ended like this in the 80s. They ended on a still frame, or walking into the field, or walking into the city. This movie just, we're done. We're done. Just crash.
We're done with this.
Like, windows sound like, pa-donk. But
that's old school Hollywood, too, by the way.
It is old school. Yeah. But the final scene, not the explosion, not the thrilling, the really cool airplane scene. No, the scene when Davey has to kill the terrorist, and how, you know, this is where it blurs. I think this is the controversial. Like, is Jack real or is he imaginary? What's your take on the whole thing?
Yeah, I know that was interesting too. I think the whole him dying. With the bullets and stuff, I think that was just his acceptance, Davey's acceptance of he no longer needs.
Can we describe that scene real quick?
Sure.
I played a clip where the bad guy was threatening Henry Thomas, and you hear Dabney Coleman in the back going, shoot him, like he's trying to convince him to shoot him, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But then, like, the movie makes you think that Dabney Coleman could actually be seen by the bad guy for a second.
Yeah, but I think it's because Davey keeps looking
over. Yeah, exactly. So that's exactly.
He thinks that, like, there's somebody over there, and then he shouts, and then he finally says something, like, to Jack Flack, and then so the guy just shoots him. He's like, I'm getting this guy out of the way.
Then you see Jack Flack, and you see him, like, nothing's wrong with him, right?
Yeah, and then all of a sudden,
but then
he starts leaking.
Oh, no. Then he takes out the toy. He gets mad at Jack, and he says, "I don't need you." And he crushes the toy. Remember, because he carries the little toy. Right. And then after that, again, children's film meant for children. Blood just starts gushing out of his chest and bullet holes just gushes
spontaneously, like they weren't there before. So that's why I think it's all in his mind. Like, it's making sense to Davey that, okay, you know, oh, maybe like someone finally saw him and like that he died and like his subconscious is just playing like this trick on him.
And
making close out on this chapter of his life, I think.
I agree. I had to watch it twice because I always remember him seeing Jack, but there's a split second when they show his face and you can see his eyes looking to the side and you could tell the terrorist is seeing his face and he's looking, he's like, what are you looking at? That's it. Jack's not real. Like he doesn't become real. You know, it's like you said, he manifested it. He's probably some sort of like undiagnosed schizophrenia where he's seeing things. Let's be honest here. Kids can get sick too. But and it's pretty gruesome and it's sad because he fades away. And you know what that reminded me of? That reminded me of the death of Bing Bong from Inside Out.
I thought about that too.
You're like, goodbye. You don't need me anymore.
I thought about that too.
Goodbye. I'm just going to fade.
Pixar loves their Last Starfighter and Cloak and Dagger.
Actually, Pixar has been accused of plagiarizing before. Like they've been.
I know.
Like you could take most of their movies and find an analog to an 80s movie. The most egregious one, the most obvious one is Cars and Doc Hollywood. Like where they basically just rip that one off.
I never really thought about that.
There's a bunch of them too. I mean, these are guys from the 80s. Of course they grew up with this stuff. And I'm not shying them. I mean, Spielberg and Lucas just ripped off the 50s. You rip off what did Steve Jobs say? You know, good artists create, great artists steal. So there you go. But Bing Bong, a.k.a. Dabney Coleman. Like, goodbye, I'm just going to fade away. You don't need me anymore about my usefulness. the evil old couple get foistered on the airport. They grab a gun. They shoot someone. They shoot an officer. Because, you know, only once before. They should get riddled with bullets, but they don't. The whole airport, one cop. But they get on the airplane. There's a bomb for some reason. Dad turns out to be the real hero. Walks out of the explosion in the shadows. Don't ask me how. I have you, Dad. I don't need him anymore. But there is one thing, though. There is one weird part, though, that gets me.
Mm.
Before he dies, Jack says, oh, your father was the same way. Didn't need me anymore.
Yeah.
And I thought to myself, is this a Toy Story scenario?
Ooh, yeah.
Like, was because you heard this before,
I like that
right?
too, though. I like that too, though. I like that it was the, like, he was like the ostensible spirit of you know, someone else's unplayed with imaginary friend. I kind of like that.
Well, in Drop Dead Fred, like, have you seen Drop Dead Fred?
I've not, no.
Oh, it's not a good movie, but it's a good idea that I think people go back to.
I've seen parts of it, but I don't think I've seen it.
Little girl has an imaginary friend, and she gets trapped. The friend gets trapped in a wind-up box and gets loose when she's an adult.
There's a
movie with Gerard Depardieu and Whoopi Goldberg that's very similar, where he plays an imaginary friend come to life. I forget what it's called, but it's Gerard Depardieu before he became bloated whale. Before he became really weird. It's the Toy Story paradox has always got to me because, you know, we talked about this, like, was Woody Andy's father's toy that handed down, and is Woody the protector of Andy, right? When Jack says, oh, you know, your father's, like, I get the impression that maybe the father gave Davy the toy, and he kept
the toy,
it.
The toy is the, like, the spirit of.
Yeah, or of sim- the, or yeah. symbolic, like, and when he broke it, he's like, you know, I've grown up now, I don't need the toy anymore. But I think you can look at it like that. I think that's why I like these movies, Ethan, because we can have these discussions because Toy Story was smart never to explain what happened to Andy's dad. These movies never over-explain it because if you're an 80s kid, you're watching this, you can identify with being murdered, right? But you can identify with being on your own after school. You can identify with going to the mall. You can identify with having one parent. You know, I said this before, but Transformers the movie, the animated movie, when Optimus Prime died, people cried. And adults didn't understand that. They didn't understand why you would cry. And they realized that for a lot of kids, that character was a surrogate father figure, you know, because they didn't have fathers. You know, the 80s were the first generation where most of the children, like, didn't go home to two-parent households. And a lot of time there was no dad there. And so, you know, I think they misunderstood that in the 80s. They didn't quite understand that you couldn't market it as a selling point. But it's as an emotional narrative thing, I think it struck a chord. And I think that's why children like me, well, not children, but grown-ups like me, we gravitate towards that now, because we sort of look back at that as nostalgic, like instead of traumatizing, like it really was.
Yeah, and I think the relationship between the father and the son in Cloak and Dagger is one of the more accurate ones from of one of those types of households, like a single father household, at least. Like I said, like there wasn't any, like, yeah, the dad has some, you know, he could tell he's kind of hurting about something.
Yeah,
he has some resentments, but at the same time, like you could tell he's not a jerk. Like,
no,
he's never a jerk. And a lesser movie would have made him like military man, you know, and he would have been like, you gotta don't watch TV. Clean up after.
Well,
somebody.
He does say you gotta quit those games, but he doesn't say it.
Yeah, exactly.
He doesn't say that unkindness. Like,
yeah, but and part of it's the acting, part of it's how the character is written. But yeah, it's a combination of both, but he's not the archetype, you know, military militant dad, you know, he gets the imagination side, but he also is like, you know, he just lost his wife he lost his wife and, you know, reality is hitting him hard. You know, he wants his son to embrace reality. And that's what I was going to say about the hero's journey aspect of it is, you know, if Star Wars is the definitive hero's journey tale where, you know, the hero is acquiescent about being, you know, he's kind of dragooned into the role of hero. This is a Cloak and Dagger is about a protagonist who wants to be a hero. He's like looking for it.
Mm-hmm.
And so he kind of like throws himself into this situation. And then once he's there, he's like, oh, wow. Like I bit off more than I could chew. And, you know, in a hero's journey, the true morality of the hero kind of comes out along the way. Whereas this one, the true morality of the hero was always there from the start, and we see it. And then he's kind of being tempted to, you know, use the gun and to kill this guy. And that's kind of happening for him. So it's kind of like an inverse of the hero's journey, which I kind of liked about it, and it's an inverse of The Last Starfighter. And I think they're kind of like two sides of the same
thing. They are. And it's interesting that every time you see a movie up until Jojo's Rabbit, when they use that type of imaginary friend, it was always with adults after that. And I think the most famous example would probably be, Fight Club from 1999.
Oh, yeah.
You know, where they tried to use it as like the concept was like this imaginary friend, this friend of yours is a schism of your own psychosis. Yeah. And here I don't think it is. I think it's wish fulfillment. I think it's, you know, and what's funny, and I'll just say this, I love Dabney Coleman. I grew up with Dabney Coleman. Same year as this movie came out, one of the movies you mentioned came out, Muppets Take Manhattan. He was also in
that,
and he was great.
He was in that movie.
He was great. He was great. I love Dabney Coleman. Dabney Coleman is one of those actors that I think, sadly, is, like I was mentioning before, is sort of his time, you know, and he's great. I loved him in everything I've ever seen him in. He's fantastic. I don't even want to get into his record, but I'll say this. You haven't seen 9 to 5 with Dolly Parton? Watch it. Mm-hmm. Watch Dolly. 9 to 5 is great. Tootsie's great. He was in War Games.
He is in War Games?
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, well, there you go. I forgot about that. Huh, see, yes. I got to go back and watch this stuff again. So, but anyway, you know, I was thinking of this. If they had a bigger budget, you know who they probably would have got for the character of Jack Black? And when I say it, you're going to laugh. Sean Connery.
Of the Dabney Coleman role?
Yeah, and it would have been too serious. Okay. It would have been too serious.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah, it's not. Yeah, it would have been. Yeah, it would have been almost overshadowed. It's almost because Dabney Coleman was an A-lister,
no.
But at the same time, everyone knows his face.
But he's got a
and
type,
I think
though.
He was the perfect, yeah,
like he's usually.
I think he was perfect for the role, though.
But
sometimes when you get an A-lister like that, it almost overshadows the movie.
It does. Yeah.
And as big as Henry Thomas was because of E.T., I don't think he was really ever an A-lister, was he?
No, and he still isn't. He's still
as
happy,
big
though.
As E.T. Yeah,
you know what's funny though? What's ironic about the whole thing is that he's kind of living in. He's done some Stephen King adaptations. He does a lot with that one director who does all the Stephen King stuff. He was in guy who did Doctor Sleep. What was his name?
Oh,
he was in Doctor Sleep too. He played He played the bad father.
Okay, I didn't see Doctor Sleep.
I don't want to spoil anything for you, but it was one of those Stephen King sequels that didn't need to happen. Can we just say that?
Yeah,
Mike Flanagan, by the way, Mike Flanagan.
Okay, yeah,
yeah. I don't know if you're familiar too much, but he did Gerald's Game. Goodness gracious, he does that one show on Netflix about the haunted houses. So, But okay. But going back to the Henry Thomas, the first movie I remember him in when I was growing up after this was I think The Gangs of New York.
Huh.
Yeah, he played one of the bad
guys. I don't think I've ever seen any of his other movies besides this one now.
Or if besides E.T. Or if you've seen it, he doesn't really stand out. Like, as a child, he was precocious and he was amazing. But, you know, that happened, like, that same thing
did
happened.
Did not transition like Drew Barrymore.
Who is it? Who is the kid in Forrest Gump and Sixth Sense?
Oh, yeah, Haley Joel Osment.
Yeah, he's made a comeback recently as an adult. Mm-hmm. But he's, and he's done okay for himself, but he's not the phenomenon he was. I mean, you feel kind of bad because his face didn't change, but his body did. Like, he kind of looked, and I'm not making fun of him, but, like, his face grew up. But his face is static, and so it kind of makes him look a little bit like a potato. And but he's still he's a good actor. I've liked him in everything he's in. He's
a good actor, actually. Yeah,
yeah. He's done a lot of genre stuff that's fun. And so, but Henry Thomas, I guess he's got a career. What can you say? You know, he's making money. He's still working in the business. Just like Kay Kwan from Indiana Jones, make two movies, then your third when you win an Oscar. So there you go. But no, I mean, I don't know what else to say. I think we both like these movies a lot, but I think we both agree that Cloak and Dagger is the better film overall, like
definitely
by leaps and bounds. But they're both worthy of you watching. They're both worthy of their critical status. I would say their cult status. So before we go though, I'm going to do something a little different. I got a question for you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Should they remake these movies? And if so, what fundamental thing would you change?
I don't think you can remake Cloak and Dagger. You'd have to change. I mean, you can do the boy cried wolf premise, but I don't think you can do. I don't think you can't do it. You can't do it with a cartridge. You can't. None of that would work here. Even like the airport, you'd have to basically do an entirely new movie. Last Starfighter, however, I think you could remake. And I think the main thing I would change in that one was maybe change the reason why he feels the need to go. I think you could remake. I'm always for remakes. I think remakes are always have good potential at the beginning and sometimes work. And when they work, it's fun. When they don't work, it's not fun. But I don't think you would. I think Cloak and Dagger's good as it is. I think The Last Starfighter could use a remake.
Well, hopefully
if done properly.
Well, that won't stop them if they can. I don't understand why Cloak and Dagger has not lived on in infamy the way a lot of other 80s movies have. I wonder if it's just ripe for rediscovery. That could be it, because the way the internet works, and I think you know this, is that somebody finds something, everyone starts talking about that one thing, and we all obsess over it, like The Room or Troll 2 or something. And there's something to latch on. You remember years ago it was Mac and Me because of the infamous wheelchair scene, like, They catch on. But there is a difference between mocking something out of love and mocking something out of ignorance. And I think, you know, I don't think anybody watches The Room and think it's a good movie. It's got merit. They mock it because it's shitty. It's a shitty movie and it's performed shittily, but it's so consistently shitty that it creates something of value, right? Troll 2, Troll 2 is not a good movie at all. But it's got scenes in it that look very good when you meme them, right? The famous scene, like, he's eating her and he's going to eat me. Oh, my God. You know, like, that's fun, right? But
in the room, there's like a cohesion to the badness.
Yes.
And it all kind of feels like a one solid work of art. Like, it doesn't feel discordant, strangely.
No.
You know, like, it feels like it's almost, there's like an addiction. I think The Room is more of like an addiction. You it's watching a bad accident. You know what I mean? It's watching a car crash.
Well, we never really talked about like movies like The Last Dragon with Bruce Leroy. But there's a great scene in that movie I've talked to you about before where
we did The Last Dragon.
Did we?
Mm-hmm.
We did, didn't we?
Yeah, see, that was one of our first ones.
Oh, wow. I guess we needed to redo it again. No, but no, I'm just kidding. But, you know, there's a great scene when they're watching the Bruce Lee movie, right? Yeah. And End of the Dragon. And everyone's quoting it. Everyone's talking to it. if you've been to, you're in California, you've been to things like that, people, there's a group consensus there. There's a group, you know, there's a herd mentality there. You enjoy
a camaraderie to just a joint experience.
It's like going to a
shared experience.
It's like going to a concert, right? And, you know, I think bad movies, just because they're bad, you got nothing really invested, so you're not having to listen to the dialogue because you know it all. You know, no one's going to Gone with the Wind and dressing up to get excited to talk about Scarlet. You know, no one's.
I have been to a Sound Music sing along dress up thing though.
Oh, that sounds like hell. No, I'm just kidding. But the songs are good. But like,
no, I was a kid. It was fun though.
Like, no one's going to Sophie's Choice eagerly to have fun. Oh, which one's she gonna choose?
Lilies of the Field.
Yeah, like bad movies, genre movies, B movies. They're much more fun. And they have a lot more to offer. Like once the credits roll, who cares about Oscars? Like, these movies are never winning Oscars. Okay, if you're going for an Oscar, wrong film, not enough diversity. If you know what I mean. But going back to this though, if they do remake it, I think something would be lost in the flavor. Maybe it could be replaced with new flavor. I don't know. But I would say The Last Starfighter is probably the biggest candidate for a remake, and I think it's possible to do a good job with it if they make some changes to the formula, but they keep the heart of it. I think the heart's there, but it's just not evident. There's just too many disparate pieces that don't fit together, if that makes any sense.
No, it does. Sorry, my kids was yelling in the background.
Well, you know what? Make them watch Cloak and Dagger. I'll shut them up. This is going to happen to you. Mommy, what's kneecapping? Where's Daddy? Daddy's gone. He's not here anymore. So, but no, it's just
he's an invisible friend.
But I think this is my final thought. I hope we didn't give the impression that we're overestimating these films because of nostalgia. I think quite the opposite. I think Ethan, I don't know about you, but you look at these things without the nostalgic glasses. Are they good on their own merits? And I'm not one of those people that say it's the 80s that was better. Although I would say this, and I think you would probably agree, there seems to be more of a welcoming atmosphere for 80s movies and 80s content. Whereas today, everything seems so programmatic. Everything seems so articulated and so designed to be marketable that something's lost. And I think that's why they keep reaching back towards the 80s. They're trying to strip mine it for ideas.
Yeah, they're 80s movies that I think are beloved because of nostalgia. You know, I mentioned a couple earlier. There's like, you know, Red Dawn or Footloose or something. But, you know, I didn't grow up with this movie. This is the first time I watched it was the other day, and I loved it. And I think it's just, it's a different. I think the 90s were the last era where you could have just consistently good movies that are rewatchable. And there are exceptions to that, but the 80s, I think, is and people think it sounds hyperbolic, but I honestly believe that the 80s is the best decade for a film, just as far from a standpoint of just entertainment. So why you go to the movies, it's not as artistically innovative as the 70s or the 30s or the 20s, but just as far as if you're going to sit down and you have a pile of movies that you could choose from, that's the decade you're going to every time. Like like you said, the 70s are grimy. The movies are maybe better from an artistic standpoint, but you also have to deal with, you know, Clockwork Orange. Like, are you Clockwork Orange is a brilliant movie, but I'm not watching that thing more than once every 10 years. It's just hard to watch, you know? I don't know. You have exceptions, obviously.
Well,
Willy Wonka, but
you have exceptions, but
Star Wars.
Would you agree that you basically with the 80s, you have sort of like a tempest in a teapot. You have a generation of young filmmakers who grew up during the 50s and 40s, in some cases 40s, and they grew up in an era when blockbuster cinema was still in its infancy, and technology was in its infancy. And in the 1980s, you have filmmakers coming of age, and you have the tools of the technology available to them like they've never been available. You didn't have to do stop motion puppets. You could do special effects. You didn't have to like do Gamera with a hand puppet. You could do a real model. You know, you could have
Not only that, ships. You can rent videos, watch them over and over and over again, and study what these movies from the 50s and the 60s and the 30s and the 40s that you loved. You can watch them over and over. You can watch Star Wars over and over again. Whereas people in the 50s and 60s, if they wanted to, you know, you just couldn't watch those movies. You had to hope they played in a theater.
Or they were on like TV at like 8
p.m. Or they were on TV. Yeah, exactly. So you had that is a luxury. And that, I think, is the reason why it's not a aberration why 80s movies are so good. There's a reason to it. There's a justification for it. And it's the fact that the technology, like you said, and the fact that they could actually just fan out over these old movies and study them and learn from them.
And I was going to say one more thing, and I think you know where I'm going with this, is the auteur. Like, you had people like Spielberg and Lucas, and you had John Carpenter, and you had countless others. And
Scorsese.
But they wore multiple hats. They didn't just direct. You know, they had their hands in the cinematography, in the creation, in the writing. Like, they had visions that were unique to them. And, you know, I'm not trying to say their movies are flawless, but they are uniquely their vision. And today, everything's so driven by the studio, we've kind of gone backwards to the 50s studio system.
Yep.
Where you hired the director, you hired this, you hire people, the talent, and they come in, and no one's really connected because now the special effects are being done in Singapore, the music's being done here, we're going to do this there, the editor's, you know, the director's not allowed in the editing room, no one's really coherent, and you have a product that looks clean and nice, but it's mostly sterile. It comes, it makes its money, it goes away, we don't talk about it again. You know, it's where you can have a movie make $1 billion and no one talks about it. It's gone.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it just keeps going on.
And you can end on, and you could say, oh, well, there's still indie films. Well, yeah, there's still indie films, but think of all the indie films in the 80s, and now think of all the movies that you love that weren't indie films. Mm-hmm. They were great. Like, there were great indie films in the 80s, but there are also amazing, you know, big budget movies in the 80s. Whereas now it's like, if you know, I don't want to just watch indie movies for the rest of my life, because there is an identity to indie films that are not necessarily. I like more eclecticism in what I watch.
Yes,
and that's not all I want to watch is you know, artsy stuff. I want to watch The Last Starfighters, and I want to watch Cloak and Daggers, and I want to watch, you know, Bullet or whatever.
Yeah, like exactly.
Something that was before. You know, I want to watch popcorn movies. I want to watch Fast and the Furious. I love Fast and Furious, but.
You know,
you don't, but yeah, like you said, and you know what? At least it's not TV where it's literally just by committee and there's no identity, at least for the most part. And we're kind of hopefully moving away from that with the preponderance of like mini series and stuff that are by actual filmmakers.
Yeah, well, that's where a lot of TV people have gone to because they
look at Rian Johnson. If you've seen Poker Face with Rian, it's awesome. It's fantastic. Last year, Craig Gillespie did Pam and Tommy. Really good.
Well, that's the thing, though.
Mann did Tokyo Vice.
Rian Johnson's a great example. We talk about this guy made decent stuff before. He got saddled with Star Wars, for better or for worse. Now, I don't like the film, and a lot of people, it's controversial. But his take on it was not what the machine wanted. Yeah. And a lot of that ill will went towards him for trying something different. You can say it's not a good Star Wars movie, but it's a good movie in the same sentence, right? Or whatever.
It pushes the needle. Yeah, it pushes the needle forward in a way that the two movies on either side of it do not.
Well, it also...
It does something different. Yeah.
But it also reveals what Disney has become. They've become a machine that eats content instead of, you know, it doesn't give you anything for it. And, you know, without the, you know, pervasive hand of like a Lucas, like say what you will about the Star Wars prequels, they might be a mess. They're much more coherent and much smarter than the new sequel trilogy that came out, you know, and
to your point, they're a product of an auteur. They're not a product of fan service.
And that's really something I think we've lost. And I think The Last Starfighter has, and I think, Cloak and Dagger has, is they are very imperfect films. They are nowhere near perfect on any level, but they retain so much personality and so much goodwill that you get what you want out of them. And you really can't ask for more than a movie that makes you think, makes you feel, and we can have conversations about it 30 years later. And I can't name you one movie this year that I've seen that I think people are going to be talking about in 5 years, let alone 30 or 40.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, maybe that could change. Maybe Oppenheimer's great. You know, maybe Barbie's a masterpiece. I don't.
I have high hopes for Barbie.
We'll see.
Personally, but.
But I think that's.
Yeah, but you know, we owe it all to Alfred Hitchcock for being the, not the original auteur, but the, because Chaplin was the original auteur, but the one who kind of paved the way for the Spielbergs and those guys.
And I will say this, though.
And the Richard Franklins.
I will say this about Alfred Hitchcock. For those who have not discovered his oeuvre, those who have not gone back and done a deep dive, you're in for a treat. You know, you're in for a treat. You're in for a movie that can be fun, sexy, thrilling, and terrifying in the same minute. And few, I don't know, with the exception of maybe Spielberg, any director, whoever even came close to, you know, having that sort of dynamism. And he was better than Spielberg. Yeah. And he was better than Spielberg at that too, by the way. Let's just say. So with that, I think it's time to wrap this up. I think 1984 is done for today. And I think. Any final thoughts?
No, I mean, I love both of these movies. Cloak and Dagger, I'm going to revisit. I can't wait to show my kids someday. Also, just I thought it was interesting, one more thing, that it feels like a sci-fi movie, and it uses pretty much no CGI other than, like, the invisibility of, you know, when the vanishing of the invisible friend. It doesn't need CGI. It doesn't need any tricks like that. Other than here and there, and it's brilliant though, I think, anyway.
I am a sucker for high concept, low effects. You know, we don't have enough of those. We do not have enough of those movies anymore. I think you hit it, man. I think we did it. And I think with that, it's a good place to wrap up. And I wanna thank everybody for listening to the Movie Time Podcast from your Pop Zara pals at Pop Zara Press. This has been Nathan Evans, managing editor of Pop Zara. Struggling through a voice that just got repaired. The other end was Mr. Editor himself, Mr. Ethan Brown. Ethan, as always, thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Yep. And we will see everybody next time. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to the Pop Zara Podcast. Remember to like, follow, share, and subscribe on your favorite podcast app or service.